Hello, welcome to Beamcast. This is the August 30th edition of the ShonenBeam.com podcast. My name is Jean.
My name is Drew.
My name is Clint.
Please join the Shonen Beam social network. We are now on Facebook, Twitter, my anime list. You can check us out on IRC, Shonen Beam on the Ryzon network. And as always, please feel free to email the show, shonenbeam@gmail.com. We have to start, obviously, with something that is not exactly shonen-related, but is still very, very hugely important in the world of anime. Very sad news over the past week to learn the death of Satoshi Kon, the brilliant visionary director, writer, sometimes animator, behind such works as The Magnetic Rose in Memories, Millennium Actress, Tokyo Godfathers, Paprika, Perfect Blue. I mean, really, really amazing, amazing works. I happen to be quite a big fan, and I would imagine that the two of you were also. Drew, do you have anything that you'd like to say briefly on Satoshi Kon, the works that he created, and your final thoughts on him?
Certainly. Paprika makes a really good crowd pleaser, and he's definitely got a very definite sense of vision as a director. It's definitely sad to see him go without producing more.
Mm-hmm. Clint, do you have any thoughts on Satoshi Kon?
Yeah, just it's sad to see him go. We've lost a really great animator who did truly like inspirational and unique things that you really don't see anymore. Millennium Actress in particular kind of paved the way for a lot of things.
Yeah, that happens to be my favorite work of his, one of my favorite films, not even just anime films, but just films full stop. Truly, truly a brilliant, brilliant man who passed away far too soon. It is worth mentioning, and it's worth all of you who are fans or even just curious about this to go look up translations of his last words, because you can see just how eloquent and how dedicated to his craft he was. Really, the anime industry is worse off not to have him anymore. He will be sadly missed. Ultimately, this is, however, a shonen-related show, so we are going to get back to our regular topic, which is an awkward transition, I apologize, but there's some good news in the world of shonen for fans of Watase Yu. Arata Kangatari, which is currently running in Shonen Sunday, is set to receive an anime adaptation in 2011, which is a rumor from someone who provides quite a bit of information through the Manga Helpers forums and through his own French website. It's Heiji-sama, for those of you that might be familiar with the name, who has claimed this to be true. I assume he's taking it directly from Shonen Sunday magazine. Arata Kangatari is the first shonen work by the famed shoujo author Yu Watase, so should be interesting. I know that it's been getting it's been increasing in steam, increasing in popularity as the series has gone on, so that's some good news for that series. One Piece, which is a series that is already well established, has sold over 20 million volumes of the manga in 2010 alone, which is the first time that has ever happened since Oricon has began posting Japanese book ranking charts in 2008. It has outranked the second place series, which is Naruto, by over 15 million copies. So, you know, we say it every once in a while, but once again, you know, this just in, One Piece is ridiculously popular. That said, though, not all is quite well for Shueisha. Shueisha publishers of One Piece and Naruto and other and Shonen Jump in general, Shueisha has reported its first ever fiscal year in the red, their first ever annual loss. This is Shueisha as a company as a whole, so it's not just the publishing division, it's not just the Shonen aspect of them. As a matter of fact, sales of Weekly Shonen Jump itself actually went up. But overall, as a company, Shueisha's first ever year in the red, which is kind of notable. Then again, you have to say this: the economy that the entire world is embroiled in. It's not terribly surprising to see a company with a loss out there, but worth keeping an eye on at the very least. And more Shueisha-related news, but this time specifically to one series, Gintama. The upcoming release of the Gintama movie DVD is set to bundle in a bonus new animation. The movie, in case you missed it earlier this year, is a retelling of the Benizakura arc, one of the most popular arcs in the series Gintama. The movie, from what I'm aware of, did fairly well, and the DVD is set to be released December 15th, and it's going to have a bonus DVD with all new animation. It's also going to have a cast and staff interviews, a drama CD, and a strip of film used in the actual theatrical run of the film. That's all for the limited edition, obviously. There's a couple other things, too, a theater pamphlet, a pinup poster. Quite a nice package there for anyone that might be able to get their hands on that is a Gintama fan. The Oricon rankings for the week of August 16th through the 22nd. At the top of the rankings this week is Detective Conan, volume number 69, having sold 330,000 volumes. In second place is Fairy Tail, volume 22, at just over 319,000. Still on the charts this week is Full Metal Alchemist Volume 26, 237,000 more volumes this week to bring the total over a million volumes sold for Volume 26. Number four is Hayate no Gotoku Volume 25, and rounding at the top five is Kekkaishi Volume 30. This is a Shonen Sunday and Shonen Magazine heavy release week. So also on the list we see Negima Daiya no A, also known as Diamond no Ace or Ace of the Diamond. One Piece 59 still on the list. We have a secondary release of a Hayate no Gotoku, some kind of special book, a Sayonara Zetsubo Sensei. So quite a bit of Sunday and magazine releases there. But it's interesting to see. I mean, even the highest selling Sunday and magazine series are just edging 300,000. That's not exactly jump numbers there, so they could stand to improve. Looking at release dates for this upcoming week, we have in anime Naruto Season 3 Box Set Number 2 on DVD for $49.99. This is actually the beginning of the notorious filler. This starts the episode directly after the last canon episode of the original Naruto series. So right after the fight at the waterfall between Naruto and Sasuke, there's almost 2 years worth of filler. This is the first of that filler. So Clint, recommendations on that?
Don't buy. Whatever you do, just don't buy. Avoid that 80 episodes of filler as much as you possibly can.
Give it as a gag gift to Clint so he can set it on fire. Yeah. And throw it at Dan Subs.
Fantastic idea. We do accept gifts, but only terrible ones. Also, another Season 3 Part 2, One Piece Season 3 Part 2 on DVD, retailing for $49.98. That is 1 cent cheaper. Oh, the value. This is the area of Skypiea where the crew is split up into two different groups. There's the crew that's left on the ship, and then the trio of Luffy, Sanji, and Usopp who go into the little raft and undertake the ordeal of balls. So plenty of jokes to be made there, as always, but that's actually a really interesting stretch of episodes. I happen to be a big fan of Skypiea, but in terms of content itself, at least, I would say those episodes are worth buying. Not sure about the $49.98 price point, but then again, you can probably already find it cheaper than that on Right Stuff or on other retailers. In manga, we have Volume 32 of Bleach coming out this week for $9.99. This is the section of the story where Ichigo and Grimmjow are fighting, which I think is Drew's favorite part of the manga.
I'm not that excited.
Volume 12 of Elemental Gelade, or Gerard, or however you choose to interpret that, for $10.99. And Suzuka, which is being released, sadly, in Omnibus Edition. So this is the volume that contains volumes 13 through 15. So this is the second-to-last Omnibus Edition, because there are three more individual volumes to go, which will surely be compiled into one Omnibus volume. That is retailing for $21.99. I happen to be a huge fan of Suzuka. It's, in my opinion, the only romantic comedy series that has ever ended well, so I would recommend picking that up personally. The poll, the weekly poll. Last week, we asked you what ending of the manga series options that we gave you did you enjoy the most? The options were Cross Game, Death Note, Fullmetal Alchemist, Love Hina, Rurouni Kenshin, Shaman King, and Slam Dunk. Kenshin, obviously, the manga ending, not the anime ending, and Shaman King was the Kung Zhang Bang ending, not the original amusing ending. And our resounding winner here is Fullmetal Alchemist with 39% of the vote. In second place, quite surprisingly, honestly, but pleasantly surprising, is Shaman King with 26% of the vote. Third place would be Death Note with 16%. Following that is Slam Dunk with 8%, Cross Game with 5%, and this just in very, very late. We had to actually do the show later than usual. Love Hina got a vote. So it tied with Rurouni Kenshin, one vote apiece, 3% there. So thank you very much to all of you who participated in that. I think Clint and I were a little bit surprised that Cross Game didn't get any more support than it did. I suppose that just reflects that sports series in general are just not as popular, not as widely read here as they are in Japan. But again, we cannot emphasize enough, read Cross Game. It is absolutely fantastic, and the ending is brilliant. This week's poll... one that I actually find really interesting. What underlying power system concept do you find the most interesting? By which we mean the original concept upon which all techniques in that series universe are built upon. So the options that we have for you are alchemy from Fullmetal Alchemist, for lack of a better term, changing A to B, the system in Law of Ueki, devil fruits from One Piece, gourmet cells from Toriko, Nen from Hunter x Hunter, and Stans from JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. So I think it's pretty self-explanatory what exactly we are asking. What underlying power system concept is the most interesting? So I'll turn it over to you guys. Clint, what do you find the most interesting of those six options?
All of them are really good. Like, it's a good selection of powers that I find interesting, but I can't really say anything other than alchemy. I mean, it's so revolutionary. It basically just brought science to the forefront, and anime paved the way for things like Index.
And Drew, what about you?
I mean, I am kind of a Law of Weki fanboy. I guess, like, my favorite here would kind of be Gourmet Cells, because it naturally lends itself to a power-up system that fits in with its show very, very well.
I actually have no idea how I would vote on this, frankly, because to me there are two options that stand out so much more than any other, and those are Nen and Stans from Hunter x Hunter and from JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. Nen is so uniquely crafted with the six different types of Nen, and the fact that each character has, you know, a primary and a secondary type, and the way that those are intertwined with each other to create the different powers that everyone uses. And then even then, people who are the same types can interpret them in different ways. A really fascinating idea. But Stans, I mean, the entire cult fandom of JoJo's Bizarre Adventure now revolves around this concept of Stans, the personification of one's inner spirit or inner strength as something that stands beside you. I mean, I find those both brilliantly interesting, although I have to say that the other four options are really, really fascinating as well. So this is going to be, I think, a tough vote, but a very, very interesting one. So again, that poll question, which will be up when you hear this: what underlying power system concept is the most interesting? Please, we'd love to have your votes on that. And again, if we don't have an option that you find more interesting, or if you'd like to expand upon your selection, please email us, shonenbeam@gmail.com. We'd love to have your feedback on that. We are going to move now to the Great Shonen Tier List, and we have to clean house a little bit, because I'm the only one here who reads DeGrayman, which I can't really blame either of you at this point for not doing so, and I was actually rather mistaken back when we first did our first ever episode that included the Great Shonen Tier List. I was not including enough of Alan Walker's abilities, because I thought too many of them were series-centric and could only be used to fight Akuma. Well, it turns out I was wrong. So we've taken a look again at what exactly Alan can do, including the crowned clown or the clown crown, or however you wish to to interpret that bizarre mangling of Japanese English combination. So the powers that gives him, and the fact that his sword, the way that I interpreted it was that it could only attack Akuma, it couldn't harm humans. Evidently, he can use it. He chooses whether or not it harms humans en route to harming Akuma. So, Alan Walker was somewhere, I believe, at the bottom of fair tier. I think he was the last place in fair tier. That is categorically wrong, and for any DeGrayman fans, I wholeheartedly apologize. That's solely on me. We are moving him up now. He's going to be at near the top of mid-tier. He's going to go right below Gone Freaks of Hunter x Hunter, and right above Hanabishi Reka from Flame of Reka. Just the repertoire of attacks that he has, including the beam attack, and the fact that everything, when he's using the clown crown or the crowned clown, everything is just so intensely powered up. All of his strength, his cross edge, and all that moves him up to near the top of mid tier. But now we're going to get to introducing new characters to the tier list. We're going to start off with someone who had a very, very strong few chapters recently in Naruto, and that is Maitogai, the hot blooded youth who isn't so youthful anymore. But still, Maitogai, we're looking, quite frankly, fairly well up the list. We're going to start in strong tier and look rather near the top, actually. Let's compare him to a couple of strong tier characters from his own series. Clint, how do you feel he would fare against Gaara?
I mean, we saw Lee put up a fight against Gaara, albeit out of his giant sand creature form, and it was a fight. It wasn't a blowout. And we know that Guy is basically Lee, except several hundred levels higher. And basically, with the techniques we've seen from the most recent fight, especially the Afternoon Tiger, I don't feel he would have a problem in wiping the floor with Gaara.
I feel the same way. Drew, do you feel the same as well?
Yeah, pretty much. He's just got too much more power than Lee.
Okay. Now, on the other hand, Tsunade is also in strong tier. She's near the top. Tsunade, a fifth Hokage, quite strong. I mean, in terms of physical strength, I'm not sure that she has a match in the Naruto universe. So let's, again, looking in-universe, looking at overall skill sets, Drew, what do you feel about this fight?
Well, I feel like Tsunade is like on the strength tier roughly equal with Guy. She might not be as fast, but she also has her technique where, yeah, it erodes her lifespan, but she can effectively infinitely regenerate. And I figure that that is ultimately going to be a match for most of the punches that Guy throws at her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would tend to believe that Tsunade is ultimately stronger. Again, speed, there is just absolutely no match whatsoever, but you're absolutely right about that continuous regeneration. I mean, yes, it regenerates her at the cost of her own lifespan, but for the purposes of a one-off fight, you know, in our tier list scenario here, she wouldn't be worrying about long-term ramifications. It would just be, I need to win right now. So yeah, I think that Tsunade would win that. Clint, agree?
Yeah, she has way too much power and durability.
Okay, so let's look at Natsu Dragnail, the protagonist of Fairy Tail. Drew, how do you think that one would play out then?
I think that one plays out sort of like Natsu has defense and he can fly in the sky. He's going to be on fire naturally, but at the same time, Guy, if like he's unleashing Seventh Gate Afternoon Tiger, he's covered in sweat. So that liquid gives him at least a little bit of defense, and like he's just got a lot more physical augmentation than Natsu does.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, the smell of the sweat from Afternoon Tiger would wipe him out with his enhanced sense of smell.
That's an interesting but a good point. Clint, what do you think about that fight?
Yeah, I just think that with the addition of Afternoon Tiger, it gives him a range technique, and we've seen him leaping to heights in the air, and if he needs to, he can summon the turtle, I guess, to just spring off of him.
much to the turtle's chagrin, of course. Yeah, I just feel that as well, that Guy's ridiculous arsenal of strength that he's displayed in the last couple chapters, peaked with Afternoon Tiger even. Just, he's so strong. Natsu does have actual magic, but I just don't think he stands up in terms of raw power to Guy, so I think Guy takes that. So that seems to be exactly where we're going to place him, right below Tsunade from Naruto as well, but above Natsu of Fairy Tail. Moving to Bleach now, Ishida Uryu, who is probably not going to be quite as strong as these other Bleach characters that we keep tiering very highly, much to everyone's chagrin, based on speed. He is still quite fast, but he's definitely not as fast as certain characters. I mean, Clint, do you have a handle on roughly how fast he would be in the Bleach universe?
He's kind of as fast as some of the minor villains we've seen recently, as fast as some of the Arrancar before the top 10,
okay.
the ones we saw that were no longer in the top 10.
Right. So I'm looking at a high tier here, and let's take a look, for example, at Krillin from Dragon Ball. Drew, how would you envision that fight happening?
I would envision maybe, yeah, Ishida gets some projectiles off, but Krillin's probably going to be able to stand against them because he's taken full-on hits from Frieza. And he's had regenerators to help him at that point, but he's still taken a lot of really heavy hits. I think Krillin's going to have the durability advantage here, and that's going to count for a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he'd be able to shrug off the arrow blasts. They may be very strong energy blasts, but I think that Krillin has withstood more, especially end-of-series Krillin, we have to imagine. I mean, the Krillin that withstood blasts from Frieza is nowhere near peak Krillin either. So I think that Krillin would be able to take that. Let's look down a couple here. Vash the Stampede, Clint, how do you think that one would happen?
That's a really interesting fight. They're both ranged. I think Uryu definitely has the speed advantage, and Vash's gun takes a while to charge up, whereas I think Uryu could put a couple arrows in Vash before he could do much at all.
Yeah, I probably see that happening the same way. So it looks like it's coming down to Kuwabara Kazuma from Yu Yu Hakusho then. Speed and arrows of energy versus the Dimension Sword. I mean, Kuwabara he's strong. He's very physically strong. He's not necessarily renowned for excessive durability. I mean, he is durable, but not, superhumanly necessarily. And certainly not renowned for being quick. So he would have major disadvantages in terms of overall speed. Drew, your thoughts?
I think that as far as like Ishida versus Kuwabara goes, I think Ishida has more firepower and just the ability to strike at a distance, which admittedly Kuwabara nullifies some of that because of his Dimension Sword, but I think it's still the edge in this battle goes to Ishida.
Mm-hmm. And what about you, Clint?
Yeah, I just don't feel that Kuwabara has enough speed to deal with Ishida. I mean, he is on the extreme low tier of Bleach speed, but he does still container ranking in there.
Mm-hmm. Yep, so I feel the same way. So I'm going to place Ishida below Krillin from Dragon Ball, but above Kuwabara from Yu Yu Hakusho. And our One Piece character for the week, then, to round out our big three segment of this, is God Eneru, the main villain of the Skypiea arc. Now that we've gotten through the crew, we're just going to take a look at some random, irrelevant, and interesting characters. So automatically, I'm looking pretty highly here, because for anyone who is unaware of his abilities, he is a Logia user. He has eaten the Goro Goro no Mi, the thunder fruit. So he's an electricity man, a lightning man. And as was displayed with Crocodile, he can become and become slash control his element. So him being electricity, he can move at the speed of electricity. He can produce electricity. He has an output, I think, of 200 million volts. I mean, he's exceptionally strong. So I'm looking in top tier, but I'm not quite looking at the top of top tier. I'm going to start at the bottom of top tier here. And Clint, I'll turn this over to you. Urahara Kisuke of Bleach versus Eneru from One Piece. What are your thoughts?
Kisuke loses. I mean, he can hit him. He isn't facing the physical attack drawback of not being able to connect. He has energy attacks that I suppose could connect with Eneru, but I don't think he gets the chance. I don't think he ever hits him with anything. I think he gets struck dead by electricity before he can do much at all.
Yeah. What about you, Drew?
I think that's about right. I think Eneru certainly has the speed advantage, and like just electric attacks trump anything you can do with a sword.
Okay, on the other hand, let's jump up two spots. Look at Hyobu Kyosuke from Zetai Karin Children, who has the ability to actually teleport. He's not even necessarily moving at the speed of something. He's actually just outright teleporting. And that's more your area of expertise, Drew, so your thoughts on that one?
Well, that's teleportation, and beyond that, Hyobu has psychokinesis, which gives him a number of ways to attack Enel that don't involve being physical, having to touch him, mm-hmm. having to go into combat. So he could just target one of Enel's internal organs, and Enel was shown to be vulnerable to his heart stopping before he restarted it. Mm-hmm. If Hyobu targets one of the other internal organs that he can't restart via electricity, then that would be the end of the battle, and he could do that.
Makes sense to me. So then we're looking at Medusa above or below her, Medusa of Soul Eater. Clint, how do you feel about that fight?
It's a really interesting fight that basically, in my mind, plays out with both of them having a problem hurting the other. I mean, Medusa has vectors, which any kind of energy, electricity, is just going to get rerouted away from her every time he tries to attack her. And at the same time, he's so fast that the snakes Medusa has will have an initial problem catching him or hitting him, dealing any kind of damage. She can't really tear him apart because he can just reform after that.
Yeah, it's a really, really confusing fight. How do you feel about this one, Drew?
I feel like, given what we have just learned about Haki, that it can be used to hit Logia users, I feel confident saying that like actual magic could be used to harm them. If she hits Enel with something like Vector Blade, it would do harm, and I'm not sure if Enel could get through Vector Stream. So I think Medusa has more of a way to attack Enel than he has to attack her.
I get the feeling that all three of us are envisioning a very long and protracted battle between the two. Very much a stall war, with Medusa having her shield of the Vector Arrows up, and Enel pretty much just flying all around at the speed of lightning, at the speed of electricity. But ultimately, it does come down to who actually could deal the death blow. And while it would be a stretch to think that at any point Eneru would be able to get electricity inside the shield of vectors, which would repel electricity at any turn, it isn't out of the realm of possibility to think that Medusa would be able to ultimately hit him with an arrow or two, enough to kill him off. I think it would be quite a long battle, but I think that Medusa would take it. How do you feel about that, Clint? Do you agree?
Yeah, I pretty much agree with you. It's going to turn into a stall war, and in the end, Medusa has more ability to connect with Eneru than he has to connect with her.
And Drew, do you feel the same?
That's what I think it's going to come down to.
Okay. So he goes right below Medusa, but above Urahara Kisuke. He is top tier. Another strong character up there. Let's look now at a character from Toriko, Sani. We needed another Heavenly King to round out our group there. So Sani, certainly not as high as what we were just talking about, but still quite a strong character. Let's begin looking in the strong tier, and let's look at Tsunade from Naruto. Drew, your thoughts?
My thoughts on that is that Tsunade is probably going to be able to charge in really fast, and she's going to be able to have regeneration. But, I mean, essentially what you can get down to Sonny's power is that he has absolute awareness of the area around him via hair that stretches out really long, and he has some pretty powerful pummeling techniques with, like, the hair demon that we see him pull out in that one fight. Assuming right. he would use that, assuming he's not worried about, like, what people are watching around him, mm-hmm. then I think he's going to be able to beat Tsunade on virtue of, like, being able to deflect her with hair and being able to deal the death blow.
Okay, so that is a character very near the top of strong tier. So let's, for argument's sake, let's look at the bottom of high tier, see if we are starting to place Sonny incorrectly. Maka and Soul from Soul Eater, Clint, how do you think that fight would play out?
They can fly. They're outside of his range. The effective range for his hair is 25 feet, I guess. And they've got ranged attacks to deal with him. While he does have a very strong defense, it is still a physical defense, whereas the energy swipes they're slinging around as a ranged weapon, I don't think he has a real answer for that.
Okay, so let's take a look one notch down at the bottom of high tier at Yoshimori. Drew, what are your thoughts on that?
Sonny's still talking about an all-physical attack. He's just not going to be able to get through the Zekai. All Yoshimori really has to do is walk forward until he gets to Sonny.
Good point. Okay, so Monkey D. Luffy, then, who, again, this is the Luffy as he is currently being tiered, pre-time skip, pre-him learning about anything about Haki. So, you know, we ultimately, obviously, will have to re-tier a lot of these One Piece characters. But looking at Luffy as the way he is, the way that we have seen him up till now, Clint, your thoughts on Sonny versus Luffy?
Sonny does have the incredibly strong hairs, and he has control over everything around him. I think if Luffy throws a punch or a kick, it's just going to get grabbed, intercepted by these hairs that are in this area of control around Sonny. And I think that the hairs are more than capable of cutting Luffy, as they've been shown to, like, make a net and then cut, like, giant rock monsters into pieces and things.
Mm-hmm. What about Drew? How do you feel about that fight?
Yeah, I feel like even if Luffy tries to go for, like, his max speed, which is Gear Second, then he's still just going to go within Sonny's area of control, and once that happens, it's just Sonny instantly senses him. He's effectively moving at the speed of thought for defensive purposes.
Okay, so then that introduces something we didn't have to do last time, I don't believe, which is determining what tier the character actually falls into. So Sonny, who is right between Yoshimori and Luffy, from what I understand, where would you place him? Would you place him at the very bottom of high tier or at the very top of strong tier? Drew?
I think he makes more sense in strong tier. When you look at the bottom of high tier, you see immediately Yoshimori, Maka, and Soul, supernatural abilities, stuff that goes beyond, so stuff that you absolutely can't harm with just raw physical attacks. Okay. And I think Sonny falls a little below that, so I would put him in the physical strong tier.
Okay, Clint, agree?
Yeah, I pretty much agree with that.
Okay, so Sonny is now the new top of strong tier, goes right above Luffy. Moving on now, Heirs of Scarlet of Fairy Tail, and I'm kind of getting the feeling we have to look in reasonably the same area. Again, her power is to, her primary power is to exquip or requip. She has the power to magically and very quickly change her armor. All her different armors have different kinds of attributes to them, different specialties. They can, you know, absolute defense versus, you know, mobility. One of them is enables her to fly. Some of them make her stronger for offensive purposes. So she's very versatile. But I think really perhaps her strongest point is that adamantine armor, which gives her absolute defense. Let's just start off with Sonny, who we just placed at the top of strong tier. Drew, how do you feel about Erza versus Sonny?
I feel like the adamantine armor, like, As far as Sonny was able to get into a GT Robo, that's like an actual magic, flawless defense armor. If it can block a giant cannon shot and, like, have her take no damage out of it, and it is magical armor, not just regular armor, I think even with, like, his hair's penetration ability, he's still not going to be able to hurt her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel relatively the same way, actually. What about Maka and Soul, looking a couple spaces above? Clint, your thoughts on Erza versus Maka and Soul? I know you don't read Fairy Tail, but you have a decent understanding of her powers, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, we're basically looking at Erza like she's a tank from an MMO. Like, she's all defense. Nothing can penetrate that. But when you're looking at Maka and Soul, their main technique is basically an armor-piercing ability. The slash is designed to go through everything. I don't think she would be able to block something on that level of... It's non-conventional. It's really a spiritual beam weapon that's designed to go through defenses.
Mm-hmm. Yoshimori, then, from Kikaishi Drew.
Again, we are still looking at like something that erases all physical attacks, and Erza's... She's got a lot of magical armor. She does not have something that is like physically strong. She has the Storm of Blades, but I get the feeling that's also not going to penetrate the Zekai.
Okay.
I feel like Zekai makes stronger armor.
So we have essentially the same question then. Does she go at the bottom of high tier, or has she just trumped Sani, who was just instituted as the top of strong tier? Is she the new top of strong tier? I guess our delineation here is kind of strong tier seems to be characterized overall, at least at the top, by intensely physically strong characters, whereas high tier you get into more, as Drew you mentioned, supernatural. We have some psychic characters, we have some characters with amazing beam powers, we have characters with like the Zekai, the armor piercing that Clint talked about, a very, very either situational or just unrealistic. As compared to perhaps within the realm of possibly physical strength. I'm leaning towards placing Erza at the bottom of high tier because she ultimately it is magical armor. The concept of an ultimate defense is not at all natural. And she seems to fit better with the characters that we have placed at least in the bottom half of high tier than she would with all the physically strong offensive characters that are in strong tier. But your thoughts on that, Clint?
Yeah, I think it's a better placement for her. I mean... Her defense has withstood attacks from people that are the kind of people in high tier. I don't think the attacks from people in strong tier can really do anything to it. I think she just naturally goes at the bottom of high tier.
Okay, and Drew, do you agree with the both of us?
Yeah, I would say so.
Great. And finally, our last entrant this week is Kurama from Yu Yu Hakusho. You may notice we're rounding out a bunch of groups that were left unfinished here. So Kurama of Yu Yu Hakusho. And I think once again we're going to be looking at exactly the same window of an area. This is purely coincidental, but I think placing Kurama somewhere near where we've placed the last two would be appropriate. So once again, I'm going to turn to you, Drew, and examine Yoshimori against a character, this time Kurama, whose abilities include the Rose Whip, which can be used for defensive purposes as well as offensive purposes. He has seeds he can implant on an enemy to basically drain their life force, suck their blood, and ultimately kill them. Versus Yoshimori, your thoughts?
Kurama has a ton of specialty plant attacks. However, I don't feel like any of them are spiritually charged enough to penetrate the Zekai. And ultimately, he needs to make contact with his opponent with one of those plants in order to do damage. So I feel like that's a loss for him.
Makes sense to me. Clint, do you agree with that?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's jump down to Sani, who we just placed as well. Sani versus Kurama. Clint, how do you feel about that?
That's kind of a terrible matchup for Sani. I mean, Kurama is by no means weak at all. He keeps his own within the... Yu Hakusho universe, and I think the plants would be able to penetrate through the hair. If anything, the hair would just give the plants more room to grow, more things to grasp onto as they pulled the life out of Sani.
Mm-hmm. And ultimately, if something did grow off of Sani, he would treat it as ugly, and he would probably collapse on his own. So Erza, then, another recent placement. Erza versus Kurama. Drew, how do you feel about that one?
I mean... You do have the Adamantine armor. You have to take it from the stance that she's wearing the Adamantine armor for defense. But even so, I feel like some of the plant attacks Kurama has can just grow around that, grow on that, grow through that. Like, especially the Death Seeds and, like, the Tree of Forever Illusions. I think those are going to be able to penetrate the defense.
Mm-hmm. And what about you, Clint?
Yeah, the Tree of Forever Illusions and the plant that makes them... witness themselves sinning and kind of traps them in their own thoughts for the rest of time. I don't think she's going to be able to deal with that kind of thing.
Okay, and I tend to agree with that as well. So I'm going to place Kurama right below Yoshimori, but above Erza. So we have three entrants right around the same place, but helps to round out some existing groups that were left unfinished. As always, we would love to hear your thoughts on these entrants and any other entrants, retiers that you think are necessary, characters you'd like to see placed on the tier list. ShonenBeam@gmail.com is the way to reach us for that. However, now it is time to move on to our anime discussion segment, and we're going to begin by taking a look at High School of the Dead Episode 8. And take it away, Drew.
Well, we see sort of the aftermath of last episode where they save the little girl. She's sort of getting acclimated to the party. At the beginning, first of all, I should say this to begin with, like, the president is now dead. He shot himself in the head and gave out the order to give ballistic missile strikes on certain countries that was threatening the U.S. So a little bit of color there that wasn't about our main party. And then we see the main party going for a little while on streets that don't have any zombies on them, and then whoop, there are zombies. And they fight them, they get pinned down in a corner, they're about to die, and then the pink-haired girl's mom shows up. And in the process of her saving them, like, Saiko and Komuro get split off from the main party. So, obviously setting up in episode 9 where they get closer together, they have a little more intimate moments. But I kind of like this episode. I thought it did a really good job of establishing tension. Clint, what did you think?
It's just more of the same. I mean, this series isn't making any attempts at surprises, really. It's just zombie fighting.
Strong words. Is that what you feel as well, Drew?
Yeah, it's for the most part. I mean, I feel like the tension in the part, especially when they're pinned down later in the episode and they feel like they're all about to die, that was executed well. That said, it's also counterbalanced by some pretty bad fan service, so zombie fighting is the only definite thing you can say about this series.
Okay, let's now take a look at Seitokai Yakuin Domo. We're catching up now. We have episodes 8 and 9. Clint?
So episodes 8 and 9, hugely different, of course. We don't see any kind of a coherent plot line between Seitokai Yakuin Domo because it goes from that four coma style. So, episode 8, we see them planning the sports festival, trying to figure out what to come up with for that, and we also get introduced to a new character, the morals officer, who thinks the student council is doing inappropriate things, and she's completely right, as every episode of this continues to just turn the slightest bits of conversation into completely perverted dialogue. That seems to be what the show's great at, is wordplay, turning not dirty things into dirty things. And then we kind of see episode 9, a slight continuation into actually showing the sports festival, and they're trying to establish like a newsletter for the student council alongside that, and we have an essay being written for that, which moves all the girls in the school to tears. They're like funny cutscenes with like cats floating out at sea like Lost, and like a captain diving in to save it.
And that, I feel like that's a really strong point of the adaptation that SYD's been doing. Like, that clearly wasn't in the original comics. It was clearly an expansion, but it was really well done, and it adds to the overall, like, impression that Suda is literarily talented in all sorts of ridiculous ways.
Yeah. It's the only thing he's... One of the only things he's good at, I guess. As was hinted at in some of the other episodes, he rarely gets congratulated on anything. And then the sports festival was pretty well done, I think. Don't you think, Drew? I mean, it was pretty funny for the most part, especially the races. And Hada is always great, the newspaper reporter.
Yeah. It's her being moved to tears by not being able to take a particular picture. That was a nice little touch, a little better way to use her character than I think it's been applied in previous episodes. So, yeah, I'd say definitely a good episode.
Okay, so Drew, then, Legend of the Legendary Heroes, Episode 9, please.
Well, this episode's fairly easy to summarize. Basically, we get a short flashback of Reiner's past as, like, a corpse robber kid on a battlefield. We encounter a rival team of treasure hunters, and then they fight with Reiner and Ferris for a while. They're sort of getting pushed to the limit. They try to run away. But then, like, as Reiner and Ferris are trying to run away, they activate Reiner's alpha stigma to try and capture it, and they reveal that it's, in fact, some sort of special, not ordinary demon eyes, as opposed to like the other demon eyes that they've already captured, which I'm surprised. They seem to be expert hunters. They seem to like have a crystal of alpha stigma already, and yet this one is somehow different. So then Reiner goes berserk again, and that's sort of where the episode ends, surprisingly. I was a little bit disappointed at the cliffhanger, but it does leave some possibilities open for what's going to happen next episode. And yeah, this series definitely does good action in its action scenes, I will say that. The action in this episode, the fight between them and the treasure hunters, was very well done.
Great. Episode 8, then, of New Religion no Mago, saw, at the very beginning, we saw a pretty cool sword fight, I'd have to say, between Gyuki and Nuda, who had faced off, who are arguing over the future, the immediate future of the Nuda clan, as to whether Rikuo himself will take over as the third head of the clan. And then that sword fight kind of abruptly ends, and they're holding swords at each other's throats, and it goes into a rather long-winded flashback about the origins of Gyuki as Ume Wakamaru, which you see his entire history, the way he was born, which is rather amusing to hear a character flashing back about his own birth. How would he know? But going back and describing his youth, what happened to his parents, the transformation he undertook, his meeting with the original New Raihyun himself, and then a completely horribly sudden and abrupt ending at the end of the episode. So, guys, you both watched the episode as well. Clint, how did you feel about the episode overall and the couple choices it made to go into the flashback and then how it ended?
It was a difficult choice with the ending, I guess. I don't know. I think they might have taken a little too long in the flashback. Then again, that was something that was given a sizable amount of discussion within the manga.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of liked the flashback. This series, to me, does feel pretty derivative of Kakaishi in the sense that it has a classical Japanese horror, like, Anmyo setting. And in this, I feel like it accomplished its jobs pretty well in the flashback, sort of feels a bit more Tale of Genji atmospherically. And I like that. I did enjoy the flashback overall, cutting out without, like, saying what those important words that Nurarihan said. It was kind of abrupt. I didn't like that, but I was into the flashback itself. I definitely enjoyed the atmosphere of it.
I have to agree, but I have to also agree with Clint. I liked the atmosphere of the flashback. I just think that it went on a little bit too long. I personally felt that it could have been cut considerably shorter, and even if it wasn't considerably shorter, it could have been cut a minute shorter to get to what it is that Nurarihyun said. So, yeah, I was displeased when I arrived at the end of the episode and heard that ending theme that I so do not like, because it just, to me, just a very bad choice in pacing there. I mean, obviously that sets up for next episode being more important in that it has a revelation of some kind, but I just feel that we didn't need this kind of a cliffhanger. It's more of a cheap cliffhanger than an important, meaningful one. That concludes the anime discussion segment of the show. We're going to move now to This Week in Manga, and we begin this week with Bleach, because why not? Bleach 417, and let's just get right down to important business. Let's forget about everything else, forget about Aizen. Let's just focus on the question that is on everyone's mind right now. Does Ichigo have a mullet? Clint.
It's kind of there. I don't know. It doesn't really look like a full mullet to me.
Drew?
Again, coming here as a Fukumoto fan, that's like not nearly as extreme of a mullet as anything I would have seen. Like, it's kind of on the borderline. It kind of feels like he's just like heading for a rat tail right now, honestly.
Oh, that would be
hairstyle-wise.
That would be amazing. That would be the best thing Bleach had done in 2 years. I am willing to stand up and say that's a mullet. It may not be as, you know, Southern hick mullet as some mullets, but I'm going to call that one a mullet, personally. So the actual content of the chapter is that Ichigo shows up and is unrealistically and ridiculously calm, cool, and collected. He has whatever this new power-up is. Except
he has
that
no power.
He has no power. I mean, to everyone who is observing him, Aizen, and I think it's Tatsuki, is looking on and says that he has no power. So Aizen just begins to toy around with him, saying that, you know, you have no right to demand that we move places for a fight, because I only would do that for someone who is on the level to fight me. And Ichigo, just in a flash, takes his palm, shoves it in Aizen's face, and flies him forcibly somewhere far, far away from the existing action. So Ichigo went through a training arc that we didn't really get to see too much of. We saw him kind of talking to new Bishis on Getsu for a little bit, and then the action moved away from him for a long time, and now he can push around Aizen, who is legitimately a broken character. So thoughts on that, Clint?
I don't know, it seems a little contrived that he can just get, like, physically stronger and have, like, a conventional power-up and then all of a sudden be able to tank around Aizen.
Yeah, I found that to be rather ridiculous. That the recurring theme that I really take issue with in Bleach is that there's no concrete visualized development of a character's legitimacy. I don't like being told this character is strong. I want to be shown over time and come to understand why a character is strong through their actions. For Ichigo to just suddenly show up again, when he's done absolutely nothing to convince me that he's a legitimate protagonist, legitimately strong, he had one move all this time, for him to suddenly come along and grab a character by the face and fly him off to wherever the hell they went, with strength, with brute force alone, as Aizen says, after everything that we've seen Aizen do, after the way that Aizen's rather legitimately been established as broken, with the whole, like, rewriting the plot, everything that you've ever done has been according to my will. Very, very unrealistic and very much a stretch, even for Bleach. Drew, your thoughts on this chapter?
It was just so cheaply written to have Ichigo suddenly show up and push Aizen around. It does not make one bit of sense, no matter what his power is. Like, if it's just an increase in physical power, that should not be able to do anything against Aizen.
No, absolutely not. I mean, the one thing that could be said is that if it was a linear increase in strength or something like that, that perhaps it just caught Aizen off guard. But that's, if that were to be Kubo's answer to how this happened, that would feel very, very cheap. And completely needless, honestly. And that really is actually it. I mean, that's all that really happened. Aside from Ichigo just kind of very coolly saying everyone's name and then being broken up by a moment of stupid comedy when he doesn't remember the name of the Afro guy. There's that, and then there's Gin, like, sort of passing the torch on to Ichigo after seeing his eyes, knowing that he's now a strong character. But really, I mean, there wasn't too much to this chapter, was there? Clint, any thoughts on the you know, Ichigo being all suave and cool, or Gin handing the torch over?
Nah, it's really kind of uninteresting.
Yeah.
The one thing that is interesting is seeing two characters fight who have previously lost, like, all of their important organs within their torso.
That's the most interesting thing you could possibly draw from this. So we're going to move on, but I want to leave you, Kubo, with some profound words from Wesley Willis, singer-songwriter extraordinaire Wesley Willis. Take your ass to the barbershop. Tell the barber that you're sick of looking like an asshole. Cut the mullet. We move now. I miss Wesley Willis. Rest in peace. One Piece 597. This is actually a rather controversial chapter of One Piece. I've taken a look around the various One Piece communities, and on LiveJournal, on Arlong Park, we even had a comment on Shonen Beam itself. Thank you very much for the commenters. We have people who are pleased with essentially. Let me break it down for you first. Zoro, the big point of contention is that Zoro went down on hands and knees and is practically begging Mihawk to teach him the sword. Mihawk, for anyone who could possibly not remember, is Zoro's ultimate goal. Zoro's goal when he first set out on his journey was to become the strongest swordsman in the world, the best swordsman in the world. And obviously that means you have to beat the person who is existing as the strongest swordsman in the world, and that is Mihawk. And many feel that it cheapens his character. Others feel that it's a very mature thing to do. Those who feel it's mature say that, you know, look at the fact that he, Zoro, stood up for Luffy, took the amazing beating, damage, etc. from Kuma back at Thriller Bark that he did. It's obvious, it's been coming for a while now that he's matured. He's not just out for himself. He's not just the same character that at the beginning said, I want to be the strongest swordsman. He needs Luffy to achieve his goal, for him to achieve his own. Now, the naysayers say that this is such a cheapening of his character. It waters down his character because it's one thing for him to look out for Luffy. It's one thing for him to stand up for a crewmate. But to actually go to the person who is ultimately the pinnacle of what you're aiming for and not just ask, but he's literally shown on hands and knees with his head touching the ground, begging this man to teach him the sword. Very, very controversial scene, to the point where some people are claiming they're not going to read One Piece anymore, don't worry, we're not quite there yet. But your thoughts, I mean, Drew, let me get your thoughts first. How do you feel about that moment in and of itself?
I mean, I think it kind of fits with, if Zoro's going to have to train, like, Mihawk makes a good master, putting aside Zoro's pride, like, and this is a moment when he has to put aside his pride, where everybody has to put aside their pride to some degree to be able to train for another 2 years, as opposed to just going right back and only being, like, $100 million belly bounty Zoro. Mm-hmm. I don't think he's going to be strong enough as it is, and, like, if he's going to train, there is no better master than Mihawk. So to power up, it makes sense.
Clint, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I was kind of theorizing last week when we had seen everyone's potential power-up lines besides Zoro and Luffy that one of the things Zoro could do was seek training from Mihawk, and it happened. And I have to say that I'm on the negative end of the spectrum. I really didn't want to see Zoro on hands and knees begging Mihawk to train him. I think there were better ways to do it. I wouldn't have liked to have seen it happen at all in an ideal world, but how's he going to get his power up? But I would have liked to have seen it done in, like, maybe him attacking Mihawk and forcing him to, like, teach him through fighting or something like that. Something honorable that he could do to learn. I don't like this at all.
Yeah, I tend to be on that side of the argument as well. I'm certainly by no means going to drop One Piece or anything like that. I'm not being that unrealistic about it and unreasonable about it, but very, very let down by that kind of a decision. It doesn't seem in his character. As a matter of fact, this kind of segues into both what happens with Luffy in this chapter and the comment that we have, and I do want to recognize that in just a moment. But the other bulk of this chapter, we find out, first of all, the message that Luffy has sent to everyone. The tattoo that he got on his arm is a crossed out 3D and then 2Y. And the interpretation of that is the meeting time that we had set was 3 days from when we set off. It's not that anymore. It's 2Y, 2 years. So that's why everyone has been suddenly changing their minds and going back to wherever they were to study more, to learn more about their surroundings, to improve themselves. So now we get into Luffy and what he's doing. And he is set to train Haki directly under the tutelage of Rayleigh, Silver's Rayleigh, the right-hand man of the Pirate King. So certainly, I mean, if anyone knows how to teach Haki, it is that man. I mean, among the strongest men in the One Piece universe, presumably. The comment, it's an excellent comment from Mario. Thank you very much for the comment. And there's a couple different things I want to get to. One of them is he points out specifically his disappointment in the fact that they have to be taught these things. I mean, it's been enjoyable all this time because everyone has kind of figured things out themselves along the way. Clint, do you at all share that kind of disappointment that they're not figuring things out for themselves anymore, that they have to explicitly train or learn from others?
Yeah, it's kind of disappointing. I mean, not so much in maybe Chopper's case or in Sanji's case. Sanji, who's actively going around battling people to get stronger, or Chopper, who's just reading books on medicine to get stronger. But with Zoro and Luffy, who are both directly training under a master, and we're seeing a very obvious, this is a training arc, even if it's not going to be in the manga, even if it's we're taking a time skip past it. It's kind of disappointing to see.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel about that then, Drew?
For me, that was one of the things about this chapter that was very disappointing, seeing it finally go through a full-on training arc. In some ways, maybe it was necessary, but it feels like one of the main points I talk about when I'm talking about One Piece with people is that a big plus point is that it doesn't really have a training arc. It just has characters getting stronger, thinking up new techniques off-screen.
Right.
And that flows very naturally.
It does have to be said, at least, to Oda's credit, one training arc out of almost 600 chapters is not bad for Shonen. Let's get that out of the way. But, you know, I do agree. It's rather disappointing. Mario points out very specifically that people that probably don't have a direct teacher in this case would be Chopper, Franky, and Brook, who don't seem to. But yeah, I mean, everyone else seems to be learning something from someone, having to rely on others. I mean, you had mentioned Sanji, Clint. I think ultimately he has to learn the attack cuisine from someone. He's just kind of proving himself along the way, if I recall correctly. I could be mistaken about that. But I am also disappointed that they are having to learn from others. And ultimately that does bring us to the time skip. We have 4 weeks off from One Piece, and over those 4 weeks, 2 years of story will be passed. So it should be very interesting for the sake of our tier list, as was mentioned somewhere else on our site. Someone left a comment saying, I wonder how they'll, all the Straw Hats will be tiered afterwards. Yeah, it's going to be very interesting to see how they evolve, but I do worry somewhat. I mean, Rayleigh, when he's explaining hockey, explains the different kinds of hockey. There's the color of observation, which is the kind of like mantra, basically, from Skypiea. There's the color of armaments, which seems to be the really relevant and applicable one, where Logia users would be able to be struck by someone with the power of hockey. And then there's the Haoshoku hockey, the king's hockey, the emperor's hockey, whatever, which seems to be not trainable. And it seems as though you have to specialize in one, maybe two variations of this hockey. As long as hockey is kept to the bare minimum and doesn't become ridiculously used, I'll be okay with it because it is somewhat of a necessity. I mean, do you feel the same way, Clint? I mean, this is something that we kind of need for the purposes of going forward fighting Logia users, yes?
Yeah, I mean, Luffy needed a way to compete with the Logia users, and he didn't really have that before. He had no way to do it. And hockey definitely gives him a way. What I don't want to see is, oh my gosh, Luffy has this incredible talent in all forms of hockey.
No. Very, very specifically, in my opinion, if he gets anything remotely similar to mantra or the color of observation hockey, I'm going to be severely let down because that does not suit him whatsoever. But Drew, would you be okay with him getting at least the color of armaments hockey? Some decent control over that?
Even with that, I feel like I didn't like the explanation of hockey, really. I don't like how it cheapens Logia users a lot, I feel, and that it just takes a certain amount of hockey to beat them now. Even with their elemental powers, which essentially, like, most people were able to stand up to,
yeah,
like, on a durability level. Just hitting them is the hard part, and I feel it really cheapens, like, the whole Logia fruit concept.
Mm-hmm. So one last thing, then, and then there was the other part of Mario's comment that I really wanted to present to you guys. It's a very interesting question that he brings up. He asks, on a side note, does this training arc show that the Straw Hats are the weakest among the Supernova crews? All the other crews went immediately into the New World and seem to be faring pretty well. They even managed to end the glorious legend of Brownbeard. Jewelry Bonnie was just unlucky to have to face off with Blackbeard from the start. That's a very interesting question. Drew, how do you feel about that? Are they weaker for in comparison to the other Supernovas?
No, I feel like they could have handled the New World, like, on a basic level, but what lies beyond, like, the top of the government becoming Pirate King in the process? I feel like the Supernovas weren't getting shut down right away, but they are going to be in tough situations because they didn't train coming into things.
Right.
Maybe they'll evolve through, like, without training arcs, just getting stronger. But at the same time, the Straw Hats may just have been more due for a training arc. They may have been surviving on that luck thus far, and maybe that's what the Supernovas will run into at some point in the New World. I don't
that's
feel
true.
Like they're the weakest crew, because there are a lot of them. There are one of two crews that have two people who are in the Supernovas in the first place.
That's
so
very
just cool. That would be notable.
Mm-hmm. And ultimately, they were the ones either unlucky enough or who took it upon themselves to face off with Kuma, Kizaru, Sentomaru. I mean, they seem to have been involved in more fights that are fights against opponents of a very, very high level, certainly more so than the Supernovas who were fleeing the scene. Clint, any thoughts on that question about where the Straw Hats rate in relation to the other Supernova crews?
Yeah, I don't think they're the weakest. I think they're around the same level, if not a little bit stronger. I think the reason we're not seeing a direct training arc with the Supernovas is they're having a training arc within the New World. They're getting stronger. They're just doing it off screen because they aren't as major characters as the crew.
So they're kind of doing it the way that we wish the Straw Hats were.
Yeah.
Well, they'll be doing it off screen with all those zero page One Piece chapters that come out over the next 4 weeks.
Exactly. So then final thoughts, 4 weeks off, a month without One Piece. Gonna be a major disappointment to you guys?
I'm expecting Bleach to make up for it.
Oh, I'm sorry. You could have been serious with that. I apologize.
I'm <All right>. Sorry.
Let's move on now. Naruto, chapter 507. And this is the conclusion of the fight between Gai and Kisame. Where we see the full extent of Afternoon Tiger, which is just a ridiculous power. This is just continuing in the new tradition of Naruto and Kishimoto to draw just epic scale art. So we see, ultimately, Kisame is taken down, and Gai really, in my opinion, very pleasingly no-nonsense about it. He stood over him, says, "Don't move." The second the Kisame begins to even twitch, he punches him in the chest. I mean, just first of all, before we move on to the rest of the chapter, Clint, the guy Kisame fight, how do you feel about it?
That was a great fight. Appropriately epic scale, just the huge, huge attack scale that we've come to know in the most recent chapters. Naruto is really building into something massive. It's really developing tension and maturity. And the way that Guy was just not willing to give any chances to Kisame, he just soundly defeated him and then had him on the ground. Expect all that to go down the drain as soon as we see Sasuke.
Of course, but you know, let's take what positives we can out of whatever we're presented with. Drew, your thoughts on Guy versus Kisame?
It was really well paced. Like, you could call it. It took a maximum of 3 chapters, more like 2. And mm-hmm. for like a climactic battle, it was done on an epic enough scale that it feels right. So like it's drawn on an epic ending style of scale, but at the same time, it's well paced, which is a problem Naruto really had after the time skip.
Absolutely. So,
it's good to see it correcting that.
Yeah, strongly agree with that. That was a huge problem, and this has been fantastic. So after Kisame has been defeated, they lock him up in like headstocks or something, and they read his mind, which perhaps you were able to infer from the very subtle metaphor used of the ninja touching his head and then looking at a giant brain. I don't know if you understood that they were going for mind reading there, but they were. And ultimately, we get to see a Kisame flashback, basically. You learn about him in his relation with the other Mist Ninjas, the Mist Village itself, or his position as kind of the garner of information. He wasn't so much an ally to the people that were working with him. He was an ally to the information. So when he found out that it was going to be a danger that his allies could potentially leak information, he had to kill them off. He was very much working exclusively for the information and for his country. And you see him meet with the fourth Mizukage and discover that the fourth Mizukage is no longer under his own control. He could perhaps even be dead. It's actually Uchiha Madara in control, even way back then. First of all, one tiny little side note. You get to see Morino Ibiki in the flashback. Is it just me? Should he have a little bit more explanation, development, a little more of a role for all the times we've seen him in seemingly important roles, Drew?
I feel like it's interesting every time you see him. Like, I think that just, rather than making him more important, it's just an easy character to throw into a given flashback, because he is somewhat important in the series, important enough to be on missions, but I don't feel like he's a major character enough to get more screen time.
Mm-hmm. Now we get to see Uchiha Madara in control of the Mizukage way back then. We've been pretty clear about the fact that we don't like Madara as a character simply because of his ridiculous Moon's Eye plan. But I felt, when I reviewed the chapter on the site, I felt that it was at least nice to see some consistency being established, that he really was behind the scenes all this time. What are your thoughts on him being in control this early, Clint?
It kind of legitimizes him as a villain. At the same time, it's kind of pulling the same card we've seen with Orochimaru in control of the sand, the mm-hmm. sand village Kage.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that. And then ultimately, right when we're about to see, when I say we, the characters that are reading the mind of Kisame, right when they're about to see Uchiha Madara's face when he's walking out from the shadows, Kisame suddenly has the wherewithal and the awareness to bite his own tongue and cause the mind link or whatever to be snapped, and he presumably starts to die, or he's writhing and he's able to break free of his of what it is that's controlling him. So why was he able to do that now and not earlier? Because if he's so keen on protecting any and all information, wouldn't he have done that right when he realized he was defeated by Guy? I mean, that seemed like an inconsistency to me. What did you think about it, Drew?
I mean, to me, what it looked like is that he was going through the memory at the same time like my person reading his mind was. And like, therefore, like when he saw the point where he like, this is the country I want to live in, this is my ideal, then like that's the point where he just snapped awake. It was a willpower thing, it felt like.
I see. That's an interesting interpretation, actually. Clint, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I originally felt like you did, that he should have just prevented the entire thing instead of giving them some information. I mean, now they've got concrete evidence that they're working with someone who at least claims to be Madara and other people believe to be Madara.
So overall, then, it's the end of the Guy Kisame fight and a little bit more on Kisame's backstory, and he's suddenly broken free of his restraints. Is this the actual end? Is Kisame done, or is he going to then have some hidden power-up and get a guy will have to go Eighth Gate or something like that? Is it finished, or is it not finished? Drew?
Kisame is going to be dead sometime in the next, like, 3 or 4 chapters. Like, that said, like, I get a sneaking suspicion that there's, like, one more clash between him and Guy possibly waiting in the future. The near future, though.
I feel like the only place Guy has to go from here is blowing the Eighth Gate and dying to defeat someone, and I don't feel that he's going to do that without Lee there to pass the torch off to him.
That's a good point. All right, let's move on now out of the Big Three to Bakuman, Chapter 98. First of all, just very briefly, your thoughts on the cover, both of the Jump cover and the color cover page, Clint?
Excellent art. What you've come to expect. I mean, you can't read Bakuman and not appreciate the art.
Yeah, I really, really enjoyed the... It's very specific. I mean, the Jump cover itself was nice, but that the chapter color cover, I thought, was just really, really excellent. Really loved that. And how much do you want an Otter 11 plush toy strap? Boy, that would be fantastic. All right, so this chapter begins with a flashback to back when Takagi and Iwase were earlier in school, I think middle school, if I recall correctly. I found it really nice to see Iwase back in the old Iwase mode in this flashback. When you see that Takagi is placed at the top of the tests of all the testing in the school, despite the fact that he doesn't really care, he's not really focused on anything, doesn't know what he wants to do. So there's a growing rivalry slash crush. I mean, she Iwase outright says, "I really got a crush on him." I thought it was, you know, refreshing, kind of nice to see. She's been established well as the new rival character for Ashirogi, but I thought it was kind of a nice little throwback to see that. Did you feel that way at all?
Yeah, it was kind of endearing almost to Iwase to see her back when she was still kind of love-struck and she was just trying to do good in school and she was getting beaten continually by this guy she didn't even know who wasn't even trying.
Yeah. So flash forward, pardon me, to present day now, and we see Takagi trying to figure out what exactly to do with this story. The story, as has been established for PCP, where he's going to introduce Akechi, and they're doing this 5-part story arc with Akechi trying to unveil who PCP is. And Takagi seems to have some kinds of reservations about exactly how to go about doing this. Ultimately, this sets up a meeting, a chance meeting, as a matter of fact, between Takagi and Iwase in present times, where he pulls her aside rather uncharacteristically as of late, and starts talking about, the series, how they're doing as a whole, the bet conditions, basically, if PCP does not overtake either Crow or Natural within 25 chapters, then they are out of the magazine. And Iwase counters with a very interesting statement, saying, "I'm definitely not going to lose, so if you lose, you're ending your serialization. Okay, then if I lose, how about I stand on my head naked and take a lap around Shueisha?" That really struck me. I mean, okay, I understand you're saying something very outlandish and strong for the sake of emphasizing just how strongly you feel that you are going to win this bet. But that's a really specific set of criteria, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a little specific, like she was rethinking of it or something. I don't know. Maybe she just wants him to see her naked. I don't know.
That very well could be. There still seems to be a little hint of something there, as exhibited by the handshake, because they shake hands again, as they were shown to have done way back in the flashback. And she kind of is taken aback by it, a slight little blush, but it's kind of reaffirming the positive rivalry now, which I like. And so now the idea that Takagi comes up with is that he's going to make Akechi a rival character. He's not so much like the villain character anymore. And the decision ultimately comes down to making Akechi not turn around in the scene. And the scene is actually shown in full, which I loved. I mean, how did you feel about us getting actual pages of PCP as the pages of this chapter of Bakuman?
PCP was really cool to see. I mean, the more we see of the manga within manga, the manga that are created within Bakuman, the more awesome they look. I mean, we got a chapter of Otter 11, that was pretty cool. Mm-hmm. I'd love to see a full chapter of PCP, but a couple pages is pretty cool.
Yeah, I thought it was very nicely done. And the decision to make Akechi this rival character, first of all, I thought it was a good idea. It made sense with the story because rivalries are such a very important part of Bakuman as a series, the interplay between the different authors and editors and all that. So it makes sense that that was the idea that he came up with. And then, of course, you can go even more meta with that when you consider that all those rival characters are creations of Oba and Obata, who probably have rivals of their own. So another amusing moment there. But you brought up, Clint, in pre-show, some more Death Note comparisons with that kind of a concept.
Yeah, I mean, the whole like, let's add a rival is kind of exactly what happened with Death Note in L. And the rival has to be charming. Well, that's L. And the rival won't want to win by cheap means. Well, that's still L. I mean, it's getting really meta. It's them doing a manga about characters doing a manga that is closely related to a manga that they did.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's first of all, it's not bad. I mean, I don't think that you're saying it's bad, are you?
No, not really. I mean, if that's your thing, you're going to love it. If you love, like, mentions and stuff like that, you're going to love it. And even if it's not, it's still not, like, glaring or painful.
It is just unusual. Noticeable, I guess, is a way to put it.
Yeah.
And then, so we have the PCP chapter within a chapter end, which I totally admit that I thought the chapter was over when I saw the little logo at the bottom. But there's a few more pages after that, or a couple more pages at least. And the phone call arrives, and that's the end of the chapter. Okay, cliffhanger. I heard some swearing from some fans about that being the exact point at which we cut off. So, I mean, I'm not going to even bother asking you how you felt about that. What I want to ask you is, do you think that they've achieved their goal? Do you think that they are above Crow or Natural?
I think they have to be above one of them. There's no way that after all this they won't be above one of them. Will they be above both? I'm not sure. But there's no way they're going to get kicked out of Jump permanently, because what would the series do?
Go to Jump Square?
And
very well could be. That would be an interesting end. Wow. What if they were just canceled?
That would piss a lot of
exactly
people off.
99 chapters.
No,
a Jump series being canceled at 99 chapters. Would that piss people off?
Yeah, that would piss people off, and that would be probably the most meta thing that you could do, and the most bizarre choice of reference. Wow. So yeah, interesting going forward. Obviously, very very tense and anxious to find out what the phone call reveals. I also share your feelings. I think that they've at least overcome one of them. So we'll see about that next week, fortunately. Beelzebub 74 now, and it turns out that Kiria's plan is to get Oga expelled through violence, which seems to make sense. It's befitting of the series, of the characters, of the setting, and all that. I found it surprising, first of all, that Oga is kind of this, you know, pseudo-evil, like, demon, as close to a demon as a human can be, really. He's just so innately mean and all that. I'm kind of surprised, right up front, that he doesn't just disregard all consequences and just take out Kiria. How did you feel about that at the beginning of the chapter, Joe?
I kind of felt like it's, again, in keeping with Oga's character, that he sort of takes responsibility for people within his group. He's not really a boss, but he kind of just, like, he'll take the hits when he needs to take the hits, like when he went up on the roof to fight the horsemen. I feel like it's kind of a similar thing in play here.
Okay. Miki is the one to step in, actually, and retaliate on behalf of Oga. Maybe not necessarily on behalf, specifically, but he jumps in and delivers his finishing technique on Kiria, bends the hell out of the bat that Kiria was planning to use to hit Oga with. So now we have setup and further explanation of the circumstances behind what happened way back when, because obviously Kiria was the person who was bullying Miki when Oga stepped in to help him out. And so Miki kind of puts the final pieces together when Kiria says that he moved to Nara shortly after that entire episode happened. Miki finally gets the whole scenario and the fact that Oga was stepping to the plate and helping him out by distancing himself from Miki. So, I mean, to me, honestly, it felt a little bit like, well, okay, good that you've realized it, but you are so late that it doesn't mean quite as much anymore, because it seemed to be obvious to everybody. I mean, Clint, do you share those thoughts at all?
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's just a lack of genre savvy from him. I mean, it's easy for us to look at it and say, of course he was protecting you the whole time. Isn't that the trope? But as a character in series, I guess it's understandable that it takes him this long.
Yeah, I feel like it's definitely easier to see to come to that conclusion being a reader of the series as opposed to a character. It feels like a more natural realization.
Okay. And after that realization, all the different members of the invading school come, and they actually kick Mickey in the back of the head, and they're about to attack all in tandem as a group. And all of a sudden, there's that Oga that we know and love, grabs two of the bald heads by the head, shoves them straight to the ground. You know, the ones who are going to die are you. Some really nice action scenes there. And the chapter ends with Oga recognizing Mickey by name, because that had been a plot point when he was pretending. He was feigning ignorance. He was pretending not to know who Mickey was, still under the guise of distancing himself from Mickey for Mickey's protection. Oga actually calls out Mickey by name, obviously inferring that he knew who he was all along. I thought this was a great step back towards what we really fell in love with in Beelzebub. There were funny moments in the sports festival and the volleyball match and all that, but this is really solidly action-packed. I personally loved this moment at the end of the chapter. Clint, how did you feel about it?
Yeah, it was well done. It's a return to form for Beelzebub, really. I'm glad to see us moving away from volleyball. And if anything, hopefully we can kind of resolve this school arc and what's going on there and move straight into another demon-related arc.
What are your feelings on the end of this chapter, the action moment and the revelation that Oga knew who Mickey was, Drew?
I think it was a nice moment, and I'm definitely more looking forward to Oga curb stomping in successive chapters.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, moving on now. Fairy Tale, Chapter 197, Bye Bye Fairy Tale, which is a very inappropriately hopeful title. Basically, this is just everyone is going back, and there's very little to say about this chapter. It's just the ending of the fight between Natsu and Gerard, or Mistagon, whatever, and then everyone being sucked back to the quote-unquote real world. Not too much to say. What do you think about this chapter, Drew?
Well, I think it's going to be great that Gazeel's finally going to get his pet cat. And there's not a whole... And I did kind of like the scene where, like, they're reciting, like, the dismissal laws of Fairy Tale.
That wasn't bad, actually, yeah.
But, like, overall, not a whole lot of good to this chapter. Just Miskun's plan going out as planned, and also the fact that, like, him using the magic portal, his plan last chapter seems even dumber because Panther Lily wouldn't have been able to stay in this world, even if he had killed Mistgun.
Yeah, I didn't even catch that. That's a great point, and that I'd be curious to know if that would be attributed to the author just making a mistake, or if the author is just making Mistgun that dumb, or both. I agree, actually. The farewell ceremony, the laws and all that, that wasn't a bad scene, actually. That's probably the best thing that we've had in the entire Eidolus arc. But, and it has to be pointed out, Mario, in fact, left a comment on this one. When we finally got rid of all Gerards, one now being in Eidolus and the other one in jail, we're given a country-sized pack of cats. Oh, hell no. All the cats are coming back to our real world. How do you feel about that?
They're going to be, like, refugees from some Eastern European country.
And I'm asking you this semi-rhetorically, though you can provide an answer, but in the quote-unquote, again, real world, what people would be the only types of people that we've ever really seen in Fairy Tale to be accepting of a bunch of people like refugees? Fairy Tale.
That's pretty much it. They're gonna have to. They're not gonna be able to hold all those cats because it's like a whole nation worth of people, literally all being displaced by the dumbest plan ever.
That's true, but I mean, Fairy Tale is made up entirely of people that are like, well, if it's something we have to do, we'll find a way. We'll find room for an entire country of cats. I don't know. I certainly hope it doesn't happen. I hope that they just go off into the distance, smiling, and we never have to see them again.
It'd actually be kind of nice if they just made a giant cardboard box for someone to adopt them all.
Okay, if this is all a setup for that punchline, I will have to give Mashima a little credit. I'm sure it's not, and I will never need to give him credit, but that would be fantastic. All right, again, not too much to comment on that chapter. Moving on then, Hayate no Gotoku chapter 285. Clint, what happened in this chapter, and what do you think of it?
More rockets, and now we know that they're bottle rockets. If you look closer, being shot at the box, it catches on fire, Tama runs away. Hayate, with his keen sense of perception, hunts through the forest and finds a girl who is doing nothing wrong and interrogates her for no reason. And we're still left wondering, like, what's going on, like, who's shooting these rockets. I'm sure this girl he's run into by chance is going to have some sort of important role. I mean, girls this pretty don't just show up in Hayate for no reason. And also we have Nagi reading comics, and she's found one that's pretty good.
Well, pretty, yeah, the way that that's said makes me wonder if it is actually pretty good, or if Chiharu says it's pretty good because it's very much like Nagi's really incredibly bizarre style. Because she explicitly says, you know, that one could turn out to be your rival. Makes me wonder, like, for someone to say that, for someone to consider Nagi's manga to be rival-worthy, there must be some kind of reasoning behind that statement. And to your earlier point, you're absolutely right. To me, it's not even so much that the girl who Hayate runs into was pretty. It's the fact that she had so much, you know, quote-unquote screen time. She had a very large few panels. If it was just supposed to be some random character who we'll never see again, I think that Hayate would just run into her in a very small panel and then go on his way. She got enough screen time to be worth a second look. I think it's the dog. I think the dog is shooting bottle rockets at Tama because he's jealous.
That could be it.
That dog looked weird, first of all. It looked like it was from a different series entirely. Like Inumaru Dashi or something. Just really bizarre-looking dog. But really not too much else to comment on. I mean, some decent comedic moments when Nagi is begging Chiharu to play Monster Hunter. But
yeah.
Overall, it's just, I'm still wondering when we're going to find anything out about the girl who's exactly like Hayate, and all this other plot that's going on in the meantime just feels really aimless. Like, I don't really, it's funny, I don't know what to make of it because I was set up for something else and then it was completely dropped.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe that girl will be the one that drew the doujin that Nagi is currently reading, and she'll turn out to be the potential rival.
Could be. Although, if she was anything like Hayate, I think that she would draw like a flawless manga that unintentionally summons a male harem to her or something.
Yeah, something incredibly awesome and crazy.
All right, Kakashi, chapters 317 and 318. We have a little bit of catching up there from one of our Scanlation groups. So what happened in both of those chapters, and then what are your thoughts on them, Drew?
We get explicit proof that Tokimori is a ghost when Yoshimori tries to punch him and just goes straight through his body. Which I thought that was a good visual scene. We see a little bit of him just talking with Tushinmaru and sort of wondering about his own emotions. And then we hear, at the end of 317, we hear that, like, in order to seal Tushinmaru once and for all, they're going to have to go under Urukai HQ, which is fairly blatant bit of setup for what the final battle is going to have to be. And in chapter 318, we see Kakeru fatigued completes her world-ending spell, but then Omi, the founder, just shows up and sea snakes her, so she's going to be out of commission. Just very abrupt, typical of the founder, just instantly taking her out. And then we also see Masamori negotiating to get him into a meeting with another one of the Urukai heads, one that survived, and that was the Demon Tamer family. And she's apparently a pacifist, and they're just about to meet, and that's where that chapter ends.
Yeah, I personally, before I get to your thoughts, I thought the two scenes that interested me the most were, as you said, when Yoshimori tries to punch the founder and goes straight through him, so we get, you know, affirmation finally that he is a ghost. That was a pretty well-done scene. And then just the abruptness, the stark background, the very large sound effect that accompanies the sudden explosion of snakes that takes out that character. Two of the more impactful scenes of the stretch of chapters. Both good chapters, in my opinion, but those are kind of the scenes that stood out to me. But what did you take away from these?
They're good chapters, definitely, like, more set up towards the final fight, if they're going back to the original castle. The the world-destroying spell is done, they're going to have to go under Urukai HQ, and Masamori's trying to gather followers again. So all of that kind of points to a big clash coming at some point in the near future.
So we're at chapter 318, and you're talking about potential endgame type of scenarios. I mean, how close do you think we are to the end? I mean, could you pinpoint roughly where you think the series could potentially end?
I think my gut tells me it's going to be about another 80 chapters for okay. everything to run its course.
So 400 or a little bit underneath. That seems to make about sense. And I think that would be paced rather well, actually, because there's still enough to be done that it would need to take that much time, but you wouldn't be able to...
The biggest thing is that there's still Tokine, who's been off-screen for a while, and she has to be given fair time.
That's a great point. I kind of miss her at this point. I've really enjoyed all the backstory of the founder and the progress that Yoshimori has made. I've really enjoyed it, and all the action with Masamori even. But I really am starting to miss Tokine now more than ever. How do you feel about Tokine not being around for all this?
She's a very good foil for Yoshimori, and she needs to get powerful on her own. That much is true. But at the same time, I will be very glad to have her back whenever she does come back.
Okay, let's move on now. History's Strongest Disciple Kenichi, Chapter 395, which has a flashback itself. It's complete continuation of the flashback from last chapter, where we're looking at the backstory of Apachai and Agar Junsai. I'm going to leave most of this to you, because I actually really, really, frankly hated the chapter. I was really strongly disappointed with this chapter. But I'd like to get your thoughts. I don't want to take your ideas with my own. So, Clint, how did you feel about Kenichi 395?
I liked it. I thought it was a good chapter. I thought it helped to develop both Apachai and Agar Junsai, and I think how they chose to end it with Agar giving up the fight but killing the champion, the guy who would have become the champion, really kind of showcases his character, that he is supposed to be in this evil organization. He is a member of the Setsujinken, the Killing Fist, as opposed to Apachai, who won't kill people, even though he is that kind of the burst of rage martial artist.
Yeah, true? I definitely thought it was a well set up chapter. I thought it was interesting to see like little things that Agar did that you can see influenced Apachai as a master. It feels like it gives a little more continuity to their past together, and just the scene of Agar throwing the match deliberately and then his opponent just standing there dead after he took the champion belt was a pretty powerful scene, and I think establishes Agar pretty well as not just like a villain who did it out of depravity, but who did it because it was just natural for him to be a killer.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want my thoughts to be mistaken. I didn't think that the content of the flashback was necessarily bad. I think that the content of the flashback was bad because of where it's being placed in the overall story. I just feel very specifically that Apachai, he's been so intense lately. He's been so focused, so driven, as everyone has been moving towards these final fights, that to now see him flailing around and running around screaming excitedly to Agar, to the guy that he's fighting present day, to me, that really kills the credibility of the character, kills his intensity, really waters down everything that's going on in present time. I thought that all the flashback material does make sense. I just wonder why we couldn't have had this at the very beginning. Why couldn't this have been the impetus for the arc to begin? At least that's my question. I'm glad that you guys enjoyed it. I happen to feel that the placement is really, really false, a very, very poor placement there. Anything to be taken away? Are we ready to get back to the fight now? Is there anything else that you feel needs to be expanded upon in the flashback, Clint?
Not really.
And what about you?
I really think.
I feel like there's going to be another chapter of flashback. That's what my gut tells me, because it feels like there needs to be a little more distance opened up between Apachai and Agar for them to really be fighting this seriously.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move on now. Toriko, chapter 197, which begins rather amusingly, but the bulk of the chapter involves interacting with the ozone herb. They find the ozone herb, rather Komatsu first spots an ozone herb, which, interestingly, should be pointed out, has all the leaves opened when Komatsu first spots it, and then when he calls over Toriko, it's all completely bundled up and closed. And so the entirety of this chapter involves finding out ways to open up the ozone layer, because when Toriko just jumps down and peels down a leaf, the whole thing suddenly becomes rotten and collapses upon itself. And you see Komatsu and Toriko trying to devise a way to open up the ozone herb leaves, and eventually they do figure out the way to do so. Komatsu does, rather, as he notices that at one point each of them have a leaf beginning to be pulled down in each of their hands, and he comes up with the idea of pulling them down simultaneously, and they find out that that is the way to do it. A lot of focus, progress, development on Komatsu this chapter, and I have found that to be particularly enjoyable because he, again, as we've said for weeks now, he needs to get up to the level of Toriko. All of a sudden now, it seems he's doing all these other things. Toriko is kind of looking on as an observer, almost either envious or kind of melancholy, kind of comparing himself, realizing, you know, he's come so far, what have I done? At least that's the way that I read his facial expressions and internal monologue. A lot to comment on from all of that. So, Drew, your thoughts overall on what happened in this chapter?
I mean, it's just sort of the reason why I think so highly of this series is because of Komatsu, because of scenes like this, because he is a chef and is very good at things like this, but at the same time is totally useless for fighting. So I think he makes a very good foil to Toriko, and I think Toriko is just more silent because this isn't really his role to play. This is what Komatsu has to do. So I think this definitely does establish that he's going to have to take Komatsu to the gourmet world to be able to attack those ingredients.
Makes sense. Clint, your thoughts on Komatsu and hearing the voice of the ingredients and all that and everything else that we've discussed?
I think this is definitely leading to Komatsu just solidifying his role as being the only one who can handle like the delicate foods, like the pufferfish whales were mentioned before, and the plants, the ozone herb they're trying to get now. At the same time, I could deal with less of those glances, those silent looks from Toriko when he's like lustfully looking at Komatsu.
There is no way around it. I mean, we're not trying to be, you know, base and comical about it. But really, if there ever was, a hot and up-and-coming series for Boys Love fans to draw doujinshi of, this is really not uncomfortably so, but just very, very
definitely
noticeably hinting at it.
Definitely enough to inspire it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not as bad as some chapters of Eye Shield were for that same thing, but it's getting there.
Our Yaoi correspondent, Drew, thank you.
Yes. If you really want to see it, I have whole stashes of Toriko Yaoi.
Oh, good, good. I'm sure we can find some space on shonenbeam.com for that. So at the very end of the chapter, we have two different things happen. Toriko and Komatsu have opened up an entire ozone herb set of leaves down to the last set that needs to be opened. And Toriko turns to Komatsu and says that he wants to, I think it was ask him a favor, if I recall correctly, at the end of the chapter. So it seems as though he's going to try to really cement the concept of them being a combo, as has been hinted, and them traveling to the gourmet world together. For all times in the future, and also the footprint that we saw at the end of last chapter and at the beginning of this chapter is revealed to have been a GT Robo, which introduces a very interesting element up here in the vegetable sky, because we haven't seen really any sort of wildlife or any sort of beasts really ever since the vine itself. I mean, they seem to have been centralized to the actual vine, but since they've been up in vegetable sky, it's been all plants, and now there's a GT Robo there for who knows what reason. So, Clint, your thoughts on both of those, the potential question, favor, what have you, that Toriko wants to ask Komatsu, and the GT Robo's presence there in Vegetable Sky?
I think the favor he wants to ask him is just to be a combo with him and journey around with him and handle the ingredients for him. And then the GT Robo is adding our conflict, I guess, for this arc. Is just that's where the conflict is going to be. They're going to be fighting against this. We know that that evil organization is trying to gather up all of the ingredients, so of course, ozone herb would be on the list.
Mm-hmm. Drew, how do you feel about both of those?
I feel it's interesting. I still stand by what I said last week, which is that I don't feel like any GT Robo is going to be a match for Toriko at this point. Not like after he's evolved, after fighting Tommy Rod in the flesh, unless it's being piloted by like the Bishokai head chef or somebody.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move now to a series that we unfortunately were not able to cover for some time. We finally get to catch up on Gamaran. We have chapters 52 through 60, but fear not, we're not going to cover each chapter in detail. We'll look at it as a whole by their fights. And at the beginning of that segment there, we see the end of the Zenmaru fight. Zenmaru, the tall, strong character with the big sword, who basically just, he's all out force of attack. Just nonstop, ridiculously powerful offense. Very, very brutal scenes there with the things that he did to his opponent. To me, that was really, really excellently done. Because the thing about Gamaran that's so fun, if you're into these kinds of things, is that it's deceptively and suddenly brutal. Seemingly out of nowhere. There's a lot of technique, a lot of precise sword fighting, and then all of a sudden someone gets a head cut off or something. And if you liked that kind of really intense action, that fight was excellent, in my opinion. Did you enjoy that fight, Clint?
Yeah, it was really well done. And like you're saying, Gamaran has this ability or want to go just completely brutal out of nowhere and just thrash opponents, and there's blood everywhere. And I mean, I kind of view it as realistic. I mean, there's no whacking people with the back of the sword or the flat of the blade or something like that. People are fighting, and they're on life and death battles. And when the hero wins, he doesn't stand over and say, well, I'm not going to take the finishing blow. You deserve to live. There's none of that going on. If they have an opening, they attack and they finish off the opponent.
Right. Following that fight, we had a series of chapters in which Iori turned up. That's obviously a very, very strong member from the Ogame School of Fighting. And the ranks from the Ogame School are all beat up and worn out from having all had their own individual fights, Iori turns up and he decides he's going to fight on their behalf. And he is paired up against Jino Ichio, the old man, essentially, who knows exactly who he is and, you know, says, come at me, draw your sword. And Iori, very memorably, it's been a while since I read it, but I still remember refusing to draw his sword, saying he can beat him with just his fists against one of the four divine spears, a spear user, a renowned spear user, versus a bare-handed fighter in Iori. And he one-shots him. He crushes this old man with the spear. That's the other thing that I feel that Gamaran does well, is legitimate displays of relative strength. We are meant to understand that this character, Iori, is a very, very strong character. What does he do? He turns out around and beats these characters, who is in the same tier of characters as ones that Gama had a hard time fighting, that Jinsuke Zenmaru had a hard time fighting. All of a sudden, he comes out and beats him with his fist, with a punch. I loved that introduction of Iori. How did you feel about it, Clint?
Yeah, that was awesome. That is the proper way to set up a strong character. I mean, we've seen Gama struggling against a lesser member of the four divine spears. We've heard that this guy that Iori is fighting is on a completely different tier of strength, and yet Iori doesn't even use a sword; just completely destroys him barehanded.
Yeah, loved seeing that. And then finally, where we are now, and have been for a few chapters, is that the actual set of fights is kind of wrapped up rather abruptly between the Ogame School and the Four Divine Spears. The final fight does not take place, and the entire breakdown of the conflict between Naoyoshien and Naokatsu, the two brothers who are fighting this out, you get to see some development with them, which was interesting, but not as comment-worthy as what followed. Which is there are people sent by Jinsuke to retrieve these people from the Ogame School and force them to join their own school. So you get to see a lot of conflict going on there because evidently the people who are there are going to get to meet with Jinsuke, which is always a really, really important plot point in everything that goes on in Gamaran because everyone wants to meet him again, either to see him again or to fight with him. So we're seeing a lot of different individual fights. Gama and a few others have taken off with Naoyoshi-sama. And meanwhile, Iori has had to draw his sword, and he's fighting off three of these people at the same time. A lot of really intense Iori action, which, again, I'm finding immensely enjoyable. How about you?
Yeah, it was pretty cool. I mean, the way he's just so confident in his ability power, and he's, I give you a 3 out of 10, and I give you a 4 out of 10, as he's just one-shotting these people who we've been told are very strong. They're working directly under the Thousand Man Slayer himself. But he's just making quick work of them with these sword slashes and just another lesson of the brutality in Gamron. He cuts through the first guy, the bow staff user, just cuts through the staff and through the guy himself in what is a graphically drawn moment of him slicing completely through his body.
I love that. The scene when he, with his sword tip, stops the full force of the staff attack. He catches the staff with the tip of his sword. Just really, really excellently done there. And he just, the scene when he's fighting the nunchaku user, dodges the attack and says, oh, okay, this is a nunchaku, huh? Like, because he hasn't fought them before, but he already understands their speed and is able to one-shot him pretty much too. He's now coming up against the bare-fisted, he has got armored fists, who turns out to be the strongest of the trio that are there. That's where we are right now. Great to finally be able to catch up on this. So thank you very much to all the Scanlation teams that have caught up on this. So we hope that you'll stay current on it. Very enjoyable series. Love to have it current. Going to move now to The World God Only Knows, Chapter 111. Drew, could you explain what happened in this chapter and tell me what you thought of it?
After Kama kisses her once, trying to inspire her emotion, she's really unfazed. He feels like he wasted a shot, then gets, like, pulled in, asked to kiss her a bunch more times, explains his own, like, country of ideals as, like, Galge, and then just, like, she rejects him, tells him, I don't need you anymore, you got flustered, you're obviously not the ideal person I'm trying to create. And he's really just left with nothing at the end of this chapter, kind of. How'd you feel about that, Clint?
It's really interesting. This is the first time he's hit this kind of a challenge. It's a girl who is just thoroughly, like, uninterested in him after she flipped the tables on him, doesn't seem to care about anything, but she was just kissing him all over the place. And you kind of get the feeling like she would show up to his class and watch, and she kind of, like, wanted to involve herself with him, and I don't know what's going on, because then a couple pages later she just dismisses him, I don't need you anymore, like you said.
Yeah, very surprising. A very stark ending to the chapter, but I think a great ending to the chapter, because this is very much unlike any of the formulaic archetypes that we've seen before. For all of a sudden Kama to really be at a complete loss as to what to do next, because he's been completely shot down by the girl. I mean, we've seen him confused as to what to do because of outstanding circumstances, but for the girl to just be outright thoroughly uninterested like this, and to push him away actively... A new scenario for Kama to deal with. I loved it. I loved the abrupt ending of this chapter. And Drew, your thoughts, your opinions on the chapter?
I mean, I think the way he maneuvered through this, like, speaking now as, like, a Galge veteran, like, this looks very much like an actual failed route from a game.
Yeah, that's
like outright failure. Not even, like, a route where you have to fail to succeed, just, like, you got a bad ending.
So at the end of the chapter, though, the author in the little comment at the bottom of the page outside of the panel says, I don't think that it's going to end like this for Kama, or some variants of that kind of a statement. So I suppose we know that something is going to happen in the near future to at least attempt to resolve this situation. But I mean, do you have any thoughts? I mean, you are the Galge veteran, self-proclaimed, Drew. Any thoughts on,
like,
how this could
sort of the
happen?
Point. Well, I think you're going to have to, if he wants to get back in the game, he's going to have to possibly create a rival robot, or the other thing is he could just reload from an old save file if he's been properly making saves.
Great point. All right. Siren, chapter 131. I'm going to leave the summarizing of this to you, Drew, please.
Well, it was sort of, it felt like a short chapter. You saw Vigo and Mary on a bed. Like, he was trying to get her to, like, be consensually in love with him, or at least accepting of him, but she just keeps on refusing him. But then someone from the Senate shows up, and he's still, like, fighting her to protect her. So, and by the way, that senator, I'm not sure what's up with that. I'm not sure if, like, we've ever seen the Senate exposited before. This might be the first time. So
that
came a little out of the blue.
Yeah, I can't recall that having been mentioned before. I could be mistaken. It could have been mentioned. I just don't recall it, which would mean at least it was never really explicitly expounded upon to a great extent, I would think. So, yeah, that caught me off guard. And then not only just the concept of these senators existing, but then the fact that she says that she's not human, and you see, like, claws or something coming out of her body. I mean, you would have to presume, because there's no, like, supernatural beasts or something in this series, you'd have to think that it's just, like, the some form of the taboo inside of a wise, perhaps. But still, I mean, that's just pure speculation. We've never heard, to my knowledge, of anything like this before, so very surprising.
I mean, the only thing it could possibly really be is the meteor, like the aliens that were on that. But, I mean, that opens a whole other can of worms.
Yeah. Suddenly, chapter 131, and we presume that we're approaching the end of the series, suddenly aliens. Not sure I'd be okay with that.
There was a little bit of build-up for it, but...
Yeah, but it is kind of boring. We hadn't seen them. Yeah, that would be surprising to me, at least. And then the action shifts back to the fight between Oboro and the large beast controlled by the little girl, does it not?
Yeah, and he slices one of the hands in half in just a great panel, and then he basically beats down the little girl's creatures, and then Grana shows up and kind of turns the tables, starts just punching him out. And it doesn't look for the moment like they have an answer for him, and then we sort of shift to like Kyle and Frederica being injured, like needing evacuation. And from there, we shift to Van and the guy with the trick room. They're trying to evacuate them, but then they get targeted by a wise also. And that's where Ageha and Amamiya show up. So they obviously moved there very quickly to be able to get there from the point where like they finished training last chapter, and now they're in the action.
Right.
So it, again, opens the doors for a fast finale. It'll be interesting to see how we re-tier them after they show what they can do this week, next week.
Right, exactly. Yeah, looking forward to that. Was it ever explicitly shown what happened to Frederica for her to be in this condition?
I don't recall having seen it, no.
Yeah, that caught me off guard as well, just the fact that all of a sudden she's not just injured. I mean, I can understand she's in a fight, she'd be injured, but she's actually, like, she's injured to the point where Kyle is panicking and pleading for help from his allies. So, yeah, surprised by that moment. The entire beginning of the chapter with the senator and Marie and Vigo, I mean, it's interesting to learn a little bit more about the antagonists here, but it's also at the same time, you know, if we were going to get more exposition on them, we probably should have done it sooner, especially considering that we seem to be moving towards the end of the series. There's not too much you can do to really detail what's going on in the background of the Wise and the Tavu and all that at this point, so... probably best keeping that limited to what we've seen and probably little more. But yeah, excited to see the full extent of the Nova powers, see exactly what Ageha and Amamiya can do. But aside from that, just more Oboro fighting, which I personally didn't find all that interesting because he's been gone for so long. It's another case of, while this character is off screen, he got stronger. Now let me just tell you about that. And him finding all of those... I don't even remember what they're called. All the balls.
Is that this chapter? I thought it was last chapter.
No, that was last chapter. But what I'm saying is that for him to have done that as his method of powering up, that it just doesn't really engage me in him as a character. So now for him to still be around in the second chapter of him fighting, I'm not that invested in it, I'd have to say. Do you feel at all the same way? Are you interested by what's going on in each of these different subplots?
I don't really like Oboro as much as I like the other characters, especially as long as he's been absent. I think he can't be the one to be fighting Grana seriously.
No. All right, Zettai Kaden Children, Chapter 228. Going to go for 3 in a row, so if you'd like to summarize this one for us, Drew, go ahead.
No problem. It's essentially we're talking about the school culture fest and bringing things to a head. They decide on the cast before they decide on what kind of play they're actually going to be doing. And, of course, there's a funny scene with Patty announcing, like, why they're doing the cast and something that comes a little close to breaking the fourth wall, but it's not quite there. Patty seems at some points to serve as, like, Sheena's avatar for why he's doing things, which is interesting, not great. And then they all go over to Minamoto's house for, like, ideas with the play because he's the literary cultured one. Like, the Pandora kids are just, like, subtly insulting him, which is... interesting, and more interesting is the interplay between the hamster and Feather, which
yes.
is just like psychic communication between animals. That I found funny. Then they figure out what play they're going to do, and Minamoto's narrating it as they're narrating. They clearly see which characters are going to play which roles, which is interesting. And then the Pandora kids go home. Hyobu reads their minds, which I'm not sure how normal that is. I'm not sure if I've seen that before. It was interesting.
Right.
And the Pandora members, like Momiji, Yo, and Magi, all announced that they're coming to the Culture Fest with Hyobu. So given that Hyobu now knows who Yuri actually is, it's definitely setting up for some big conflict in a couple chapters.
Yeah, and I'm hoping to see that conflict because I was very let down by this chapter. There were good comedic moments, but after the just the in-your-face intensity that Hyobu displayed last chapter, I was really gearing up for some legitimate action in this chapter, or if not necessarily action, some very, very obvious conflict of some type, you know, even a verbal conflict, a showdown of something. And instead we have, you know, school kids deciding that they're, you know, what play they're going to do and joking about what people have to be, what role in the play for ratings or for attendance or what have you. I mean, that it's funny, granted. I'm not taking away from that. It's just, again, it's somewhat out of place right after what happened in last chapter, in my opinion. What were your thoughts?
I mean, like, coming out of last chapter, what I felt was that Hyobu's got a certain intensity to him. Like, either in the next chapter he will attack the car, or, like, in the next arc things are going to come to a head. And I definitely feel like this arc is a major setup for conflict. I kind of like that it's not going right into conflict right after that, because it would feel a bit too abrupt. Hyobu's a little bit more of a planning villain than that. Okay. And he generally tends to have, like, a method to what he does.
Yeah, you are right. That does seem to suit his character well. I suppose that the outright rage that he showed last chapter was a little bit so uncharacteristic of him that I suppose I was assuming that he was then going to follow through on that immediately thereafter. But no, you do make a very good point that he is the tactical planning sort of type. So that does make sense. Your overall opinion on the chapter then? Good chapter?
It's a decent setup chapter. I'm looking forward to what happens about three chapters from now.
Okay. Hajime no Ippo, chapters 903 to 905 were released kind of strangely all at once. I'm kind of curious as to why they held off on releasing some of the earlier ones if they had them finished, presumably. But nonetheless, we have three chapters to discuss, and this continues to cover round one of the Itagaki versus Karasawa fight. Drew, you could probably go a little bit more into detail on the specifics of what happened than I could, so if you would, please.
What basically happens in this fight is that Itagaki's on a roll faster, but then he goes for a jolt counter and, in true Miata style, like, gets downed right away. And I do not like him copying the jolt from Miata at all. I know there have been similarities drawn between him and Miata as a character, but for him to just get the jolt is a bit too much.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you say, Clint?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're supposed to feel that way, which is why he got shut down so hard while trying to do it.
Yeah, that said, like, Itagaki was sort of mediocre in this fight. Karasawa, everything about his strategy was just, it definitely, like, gives you a sense of he is a veteran fighter now, in contrast to when he fought Ippo, and he's playing off some pretty good stuff to beat down Itagaki. From,
right.
Like, the whole, like, headbutting his fist in order to hurt it and successfully doing so to shifting down his speed to throw off Itagaki's timing. Little bits of strategy.
That was the moment that I loved the most out of these three chapters was the revelation that he had shifted down. Really nice to see a legitimate opponent for Itagaki here. The way that he has evolved since his fight with Ippo, Karasawa, is really, really nice to see. The tactics that he's using in this fight, I'm really, really enjoying this fight, thanks pretty much solely to them, because like you, Drew, I am pretty immensely disappointed that out of nowhere, Itagaki just has the jolt. And no, he's not performing it successfully, but the fact that he's even going for it is very, very upsetting to me, because yes, he was aiming for the goal of beating Ippo's record time. So I understand that he needs to go for the huge, fast knockout blow. But first of all, he should have some other moves of his own origination in his own arsenal to be able to pull out to achieve that. And then just the fact that he's rushing, that he's so cocky. I mean, look, it's been established that he's cocky. We understand that. But, I mean, to treat his opponent in such a fashion, to keep looking at the clock during the fight, I mean, that's it. Perhaps it is true to his character. It's just a little bit much, in my opinion. I don't know if you have any particular thoughts on any of those things I just said, Clint.
I really, like, I don't know about Itagaki. He, as a character, I think this fight is what he needs is to get set down a little bit.
I think he at least needs to go past round two, go past the time that he's aiming for. If he legitimately gets a jolt counter and finishes off Kurosawa by then, like, I can understand him getting a down, but if he, even if he downs Kurosawa with the jolt, I'd like to see him get back up.
What if, let's say for a moment that these two options that I'll present to you were the only two possible outcomes. I'd like to know which one you think would be a better option. Do you think it would be a better option for Itagaki to just outright lose and to, you know, to have his ass handed to him and to come to the realization that I was going about this all wrong, et cetera, et cetera? Or would you prefer to see him make it past the time limit and eventually win and ultimately come to the realization that he isn't Ippo, he is his own kind of fighter, and he needs to perhaps strive for something a little bit different, really identify himself as himself and stop measuring himself against one other specific fighter, in this instance Ippo? I'll turn that over to Drew first.
I think it would be better to see him win by decision, and definitely that'd take him down quite a few pegs from the goal he was setting of win this fight in two rounds. So I would like that. Like, I think it does things a little too abruptly when it cuts off the A-class tournament with him losing in the first round and, like, him already having Saiki set up as the second opponent. I think it would kill a little too much build-up, and I think, if anything, that's been happening to Aoki and Kitamura too much, and I really don't want to see it happen to them. I'd rather have it happen to Itagaki, but I'd rather not have it happen.
Mm-hmm. Clint, do you have an answer for that question?
Yeah, I think it needs to go to decision exactly like Ippo thought it would, and preferably Itagaki would win in the decision and would go on with the tournament, but I think it going to decision would certainly set him down a couple pegs.
If it does go to decision, that's the answer that both of you have provided, and that seems to be what you think could happen or would be the best option that would happen. If it goes to decision, and if Itagaki does show some maturity, does evolve a little bit and realize that he's been going at this from the wrong angle, do you think he could ultimately win the Class A tournament? Drew?
I think it's possible. Like, I think going to decision would be a big wake-up call for him, and Charles, you don't surpass Ippo by being him. You surpass him by bringing out your own talent to the fullest. It isn't something that you can force.
Right. What about you, Clint?
Yeah, I think he has a chance at it, but I also don't think it would be that odd or out of place if he came in second or third.
Okay. Let's move now to Arago, Chapter 32, which is the conclusion of the little arc on the subway train when Lucien has...
sets on a train.
Yes. Lucien has killed the brakes and sped up the train to way too fast of speeds, which is what I say when I don't remember exactly the speed. And so
it's like
Rio,
100 kilometers, I think.
Right. Kilometers. I'm kidding. They're better. Rio and Arago have split up. Rio's trying to handle some of the passengers on her own, while Arago is still trying to stop the train with the help of Seth now, who has showed up in the last chapter. The plan they devise and what things unfold in this chapter, what happened and what did you make of it, Drew?
Well, it was interesting. Seth blew a hole in the subway ceiling, and then Arago he knew that the momentum of the train going straight was too much to stop, so instead he just redirected and lifted the train onto the street, so then just like the natural friction between it and the pavement would stop it. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a pretty creative way to use his power. First of all, it establishes that Briannock can lift about 200 tons just raw strength wise. Mm-hmm. And like Arago is now capable of using that, so that might be worth a retier in and of itself. But then the planning aspect of it, and then him just being able to execute that flawlessly, was definitely a very powerful moment and done very artfully, as usual with Arago. I also like the moment at the end when Rio's like, yeah, I understand supernatural stuff is happening, but Arago's lying about it to protect me, so I should just trust his lead on this one.
Yeah, that moment right there was my favorite of the entire chapter. The budding relationship, and I don't mean relationship necessarily in a romantic sense. I mean, it could ultimately happen, who knows? But the growing trust and friendship, at the very least, between Arago and Rio, and the way that that's being shown to develop, really, really enjoying the way that that's unfolding. And yeah, to your point, I mean, Briannock being able to lift, I mean, it's not just the weight of the train itself, but it's the weight of the train itself at 100 miles an hour. Admittedly, I couldn't tell you the first thing about physics or anything like that, but that's, yeah, immensely strong. And as an aside, for what we do with the tier list, we will have to look at that again. I thought a very nice chapter. I thought a very suitable conclusion to the action that we showed in the past few chapters. Also, I believe Lucien said that with everything that went on, at the way that they resolved it by shooting the train out above ground, that it made such a commotion that he's going to be in trouble for bringing attention to the entire situation. Interesting, really, that he's very flashy in a way, but at the same time, he is decidedly still an underling. Realizing that
decidedly an underling. I love how he just, you're kidding. Like, when they pull out the train out of the ground, he's, watching, he sees it. He's just got a flat face, but he's like, you're kidding me, right?
Well, to be fair, that's a pretty appropriate reaction to have when a train comes out of the ground. I thought good chapter and good little mini arc involving Lucy and Rio and the fight on the subway train. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely.
Really enjoyed that. For a 32-chapter series, I'm really, really impressed with Arago, the characters that we have, the stories that we've already been able to go over. Really, really loving that series. To anyone who is not already reading it, strongly recommend get in on it while it's still very early. You don't have too much to catch up on, and it's a great week to reread. Good ending, chapter 48. Begins with news that Yuki is being invited to go back home, which all of a sudden puts a very forlorn, sad, distant look on her face. And then we get a little flashback scene of Yuki and Seiji having fun at the water park, which is where they were last chapter, but we didn't actually explicitly get to see what they were doing back then. They were going down the same water slide 10 times in a row. How creative. Which that scene was actually kind of nice as a breakup to all the crazy angst and drama that's been going on recently. And then Seiji, very irritatingly, on the way to the morning practice, the morning tennis practice, was boasting practically. I mean, he had a very smug look and a smug grin on his face as he's saying, you could say that this hot season is also heating up my heart, when he's being asked about what happened between him and certain girls. And then he's obviously brought back down to earth when he sees Sho-senpai, doesn't know how to act, and then eventually he hears news of Yuki going back home, becomes immensely worried, and then meets up with his friends, and they convince him he's going to go follow her. So that's a whole bunch of different things that went on in this chapter. I was rather displeased, most of all, with his cocky attitude going to morning practice. Seiji has done pretty much absolutely nothing to make the audience like him as a protagonist. He has no fidelity towards whatever woman that he thinks that he's in love with, because he ends up on the bed of another girl with her, picturing her on her back nude. That's not exactly the most – it doesn't exactly show the most integrity, let's say. So very upset with him being all cocky and smiling on the way to morning practice. And then another series that I read is involving a guy chasing after a girl in a different city, a la Kimi no Iromachi. So while you may not read that series, Drew, you do read this one, unfortunately, right now. What'd you think about this chapter and everything that happened in it?
I think, Seiji, being cocky was a bit much. I think he was specifically thinking about Kurokawa and making up with her. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's a bit much when he knows he's, in a limited role, and I think he's brought down to earth appropriately quickly when he meets Sho there. Mm-hmm. I liked Sho herself, sort of being worried about it. I think it makes her a little bit more respectable of a character as opposed to, Yuki, who we haven't seen a lot of, and Onuma, who's just sort of been socially helped. It does give her own interesting angle to it. I don't like her being part of the harem, but at least makes her a more respectable character. Mm-hmm. The arc where they're chasing after Yuki could be interesting. It's more likely to just end up with a dramatic confrontation. I think, the critical point of this series is going to be that Seiji's going to need to learn how to turn girls down. And that's kind of what worries me, because romance series that end with, him deciding to go out with one girl and them, mutually confessing love, that's not a very strong ending for a romance series. It's better to show the relationship and what happens after. And that doesn't feel like what this is heading to.
I can't imagine that he would make that sort of decision to turn down two of the girls and end up dating one of the other ones, and that not being the end of the series. I don't picture that. I don't have any indication to believe that that would be the case, because that seems like the one major outstanding plot point that has yet to be addressed, and nothing beyond that, unfortunately. I totally agree with you that Sho is being developed and portrayed as the most mature of all the different characters involved here. Just the way that she is being honest with her feelings, to the point that she's crying, saying, it's sad, but I want him to look at only me. She is. It's very easy to root for her, but at the same time, she had her chance and blew it earlier. So I wish that this sort of development had come far earlier in the series when she was still a legitimate option in Seiji's love life. Yeah, very, very disappointed the way that some of these options are turning out. I would love to see just one of the options eliminated outright. Onuma is very, very much in the background right now, which is sort of unusual given how much she was built up for a while. So if she needs to go, you know, so be it. Or if he needs to turn down Sho now to end it officially, so be it. But something needs to happen. There needs to be at least one major development in the series to keep it readable from week to week. Let us move now to Clint's official all-time favorite series, as he told me in great detail pre-show, SWAT Chapter 8. And I'm sorry, Clint, you're not going to have the chance to go over just how much you love it. There's not enough time. SWAT Chapter 8 was there was a fight. And, yeah, it was a fight between the baseball guy and Manabizaki. And then there was a fight between the big burly guy and a girl, which I found just a little bit weird as a side note. I know that they're all delinquents and they kind of have their own moral compass, but, no one raises an eyebrow to this very big burly man having, like, taken away a girl and then outright beating up a girl. Really? I found that strange. Yeah, Clint, is there anything to draw from this chapter at all?
No. SWAT's still pretty terrible, and it still steals ideas from other mangas and tries to capitalize on their popularity.
In fact, it was ripping off Bleach here, even. In the first chapter, like Manabizaki transferring, that was all part of the Bearded Principal's plan.
Oh, wow.
Vomit-inducingly bad, that was.
Yeah, that's very disappointing. And then finally, Kyo, Manabizaki Kyo, our main character, deciding that, you know, even if it's not his main interest, he will reach the Teppan just so that he can, you know, stand up for his friends and study or whatever, you know, whatever convoluted reason.
Stop fighting. Like, essentially the same reason Kenichi tried to fight Ragnarok, and we all know how that turned out.
Yeah. So, really, really, just 8 chapters in, do we have long-term hope for the series? In two terms, do we have long-term hope for the series, A, improving at all, and B, lasting beyond, say, 20 chapters? Drew?
No, and yet.
And Clint?
I have a hope that the series won't last.
Okay. So you want to... We'll see. Lock on? Is that going to be our barometer here? 18 chapters?
If it lasts 18 chapters, I will be disappointed.
Okay, yeah. So are we saying, let's do over-under lock-on, 18 chapters. Do you say under, Drew?
Under.
And Clint?
An up, yeah, under.
All right. For the sake of sporting rivalry, I shall say over, but it's not because I want it to. Let's make that very, very clear. All right. Let's move now to the series that only I read. I'm going to introduce a couple here, which I have reviewed in the past on the website or I've included in Power Rankings, but I haven't talked about on the show before. Bloody Monday Season 2, which, first of all, since I haven't talked about it before, very, very briefly, Bloody Monday, both the original season, I think it was 99 chapters, and Season 2, which is currently running, fantastic. I strongly, wholeheartedly recommend them. They are pushing the limit as to what exactly can be defined as shonen. Some very seinen elements here and there in the series. Really, really love this series. It's all about terrorism, counterterrorism sort of things. The protagonist is a computer hacker. Really, really like this series. In chapter 38, which is the most recent chapter of season 2, we're actually kind of transitioning from a really, really intense sub-arc into, you know, the little moment of peace into the next arc. So this is kind of a transitional period, which is why I'm picking now to pick it up. We have Hibiki, who is just being really clingy and cute after, after Fujimaru has convinced her to let go of her entire agent life, her agent role, and just be herself, be Hibiki. And so she's being super clingy, not exactly knowing how this whole new concept of romance and love and all this works. Doesn't know how to be a normal, regular girl, but she's trying. So she's fawning all over him and clinging to him and saying really over-the-top, lovey-dovey sorts of things while Fujimaru is around all these other counter-terrorist agents, rather amusingly. We get to see a really nice little montage of Otoya and everything that he did to save Haruka as she was undergoing surgery by gathering all the staff over the hospital's PA system as the hospital was suffering from the power outage that the terrorist had caused. And Atoya gathers all of them to bring their cars around so he can pump all the gas from their cars into the generator. It only lasted a page or two, but just to see Atoya in action, something that we don't get to see too often. He's a very interesting character. I really like to see that. And of course, the major plot point is that Hino Alexei did manage to parachute, presumably to safety, because you see him jumping out of the plane that was shot with anti-air missiles. And he jumps down and lands in trees to cushion the fall. So he's presumably still alive, as he obviously would have to be, since we're only 38 chapters into the season, and he's our main bad guy. So enjoyable chapter, not quite as good as the brilliance that has been the last several chapters, but still a rather good chapter. Another series that I've included in Power Rankings for a while, Defense Devil. Haven't reviewed it for a while, but let's start picking it back up in Beamcast. Chapters 61 and 62 have come out this week, and it's the beginning of a new arc here, where we see some huge devil with he has a giant cloth kind of patchwork bag full of 100, and they call them unknowns, 100 unknowns, which is they're souls, but they're still kind of, they retain some of their human elements, so they're perhaps not supposed to be there. So it's left a little bit deliberately unclear, but he basically, for all intents and purposes, has 100 beings, souls, what have you, in this bag. And the power, the strength that he emits in his aura makes Kookaburra think that this is the devil that killed his father, the King of Hell. And there's a decent amount of focus being shown towards sending back Ida Maria to the human world, because if she is overcome by the demon or devil power inside her again, there's worry that it could completely consume her own human soul. And that leads Bichula to harass Kookaburra for having feelings for her or caring about her too much as just a lowly human. So there's a little bit of amusing interplay between the two there. 62, Ida Maria is presumed to have been abducted by that large devil, which leads to Kookaburra bemoaning his own lack of strength. So he ends up drinking medicine that's provided to him by his enemy because he needs to get stronger immediately. And the enemy who is involved in all the Brillhart saga shows up, decides not to kill him because he's not at his peak. She wants to kill him at his best. So she ends up helping him out right now. So we're transitioning into this new arc, a very interesting storyline going forward. And if that relationship between Ida Maria and Kookaburra is going to be explored some more, should be enjoyable. Katekushi Hitman Reborn, Chapter 303, they're fighting for pride. The Vindice are there, and they need to know the conditions for the fighters need to know the conditions for victory, and the Vindice dictate that the condition for victory is pride. You're fighting for pride. That's as high as we are aiming with the series right now. They're not fighting for any particular object, for any particular aspiration or goal. They're fighting for pride. Adelheid's chest, once again, is just ridiculously out of proportion, insultingly so, especially for a female author. And really, Lambo gets like a little couple panels here and there. I miss Lambo. Lambo used to be one of the main reasons I read this series. He is a hilarious character when he's written consistently. I wish that we had him more often. Ultimately, this devolves into Ryohei's fight, where everyone's presumably going to split off and have their own fights. Ryohei, his opponent can manipulate plants, and yet they're only going to have a boxing match. The plant growing and manipulation is just used to form a cage to surround them. If you're coming up, if you're taking the time to come up with plant manipulation as someone's ability, use that in the fight. Don't just build a surrounding with it and then box. This series is going places I really don't enjoy.
Kimi no Itomachi. Just going to make spirit boxers when he needs it.
Yes.
To hold his opponent from jumping.
Yeah, I know. The Ippo stand, of course. That'd be a terrible crossover. Kimi no Yurimachi, Chapter 102, where we see Mishima is going over to eat at Haruto's place, quote-unquote, again. So that at the beginning of the chapter, I'm led to believe, wow, all of a sudden, you know, we see Eiba moving out of the picture, obviously. Last chapter she said maybe we shouldn't see each other anymore. Nagoshi, as wonderful, as funny as she is kind of the comic relief now, unfortunately. Kiyomi, obviously, was focused completely on Kazama, so presumably she is just distraught over his death, so I don't imagine she's a love interest. So with all of them kind of out of the picture, Mishima would make sense as a new love interest, and ultimately, you know, as they have dinner, they're kind of joking back and forth, a lot of really, really positive type of conversation back and forth that transitions into a discussion about Eiba, and then further beyond that transitions into discussion about what Haruto is going to do in the future, and she invites him to go to college with him, and then she does outright ultimately say, you know, why are you asking me all this stuff? Because I like you. So she does outright to confess to him. Really, really nice chapter. After all the angst, after all the drama that's been going on recently, Mishima during all of that time has been a very enjoyable character, and for her to finally be a love interest is really excellent, a redeeming quality of the series now, and something to look forward to week. And finally, Nurarihyon no Mago, chapter 119, is almost entirely a flashback to Abe no Seimei's plan, because you go back, and basically he wants to be immortal, not necessarily for his own selfish desires. He wants to be immortal so that he can keep the perfect balance between yokai and human. And he's struggling with a way to come up with to do that, and he comes across his mother, as he says, Hagoro Mogitsune, who is obviously our main villain right now, who's trying to give birth. So ultimately we realize that his Abe no Seimei's original plan is to ask his mother to bear him again as a child. Now, obviously, the logistics of that are not exactly made clear. That's really a bizarre concept, but that's the way he wants to be reincarnated, reborn. And so you would presume it's going to be a kind of an infinite life cycle sort of idea. So that's the precursor to exactly what's happening in present day. That concludes This Week in Manga Time for Chapters of the Week. Clint, yours.
My chapter of the week is The World God Only Knows. I really enjoyed how the tables were turned on Kema, and he really has nowhere to do and nothing to do and nowhere to go with this. And I liked the stark ending of it where, like, there was nothing left to him, and he really has no options foreseeable.
Drew?
And for me, it was Arago, chapter 32. I liked getting the subway train up above ground, how they did that. I also liked how they resolved Arago's situation with Ryo, that she doesn't find out about Arago's power, but she agrees to stop snooping around and just remain ignorant because she realizes it's for her own good. I thought that was a really interesting way to resolve that arc.
And for me, it's Kimi no Iromachi, chapter 102. As I had just mentioned, I really appreciated the fact that we have a very positive love interest with no really lingering, angsty attachments behind the scenes. Just a very, very happy, uplifting sort of love interest that we can move forward with. So that concludes the entire episode. I'd like to thank all of you very much for listening. Please tune in again next week. Final Flash.
Baka Inu. It means demon god in Japanese.
Gerard Security Systems, for all your cat-protecting needs.
Betty Crocker is high tier. Big Boy is top tier. Thanks very much for listening. Good night.